Welcome everyone to Radio Free Nintendo. This is episode 373. I'm your host, Jonathan Metz, and with me as always are John Lindemann.
Hey buddy, good to be back.
As always?
I'm always here in spirit.
God help us.
You don't even listen to this show.
He's always here in scent.
Welcome back, John. It's good to hear your voice again. And
smell you later, James.
Jesus.
Guys. I need to finish this intro at some point.
Look, we haven't had this opportunity in weeks. Give us this.
We also have James Jones, as you've heard.
Yes, we do.
And Mr. Guillaume Veillette.
Hi.
Hi, Guillaume. And joining us as well this week, a special bonus guest, our good friend, Billy Berghammer.
Hello, hello.
Good to hear your voice too, man. It's been too long.
Yeah, man, it has been. I think it's been since the telethon, so.
Yeah, and I think even a while before then that we've had you on the full show. And I actually, just to go a little behind the scenes here, I was hoping to get you on a couple weeks ago when Garnet was here. I thought that would be extra fun to get you guys back together because I haven't heard you guys on a podcast as a pair in quite a while since you moved up to Seattle. I think maybe did you go back maybe once to do Weekend Confirmed?
Actually, no, I didn't. It's been a couple of years, so.
Oh, man.
It's crazy.
Yeah, and then you were going to be on it for E3 last year, but you had to leave town a little too early or something like that.
And so I got
to do it. Yeah, and you recommended me, and that was something I'm very, very thankful for. We talked about a little bit when Garnet was here. But anyway, I thought it would be fun, but the scheduling didn't happen. So very good to have you on here finally. And we have a hell of a lot to talk about. Actually, later in the show, we're going to do a feature topic on the history of online Nintendo games in memory, I guess, looking at the end of Nintendo Wi-Fi connection. So we're going to be talking about our experiences playing the early days and some of the stuff that is about to go away. And we'll talk about that a lot later in the show. But first up, we have new business. And John, since you've been gone for a couple of weeks, thought maybe you could kick it off.
Yeah, well, I did play a little bit of Steel Diver Subwars. You know, I was in the mood. You know, I'm a first-person shooter guy. But I was like, I wanted a thinking man's first-person shooter.
Oh, for fuck's sake.
The word that was in my mind was contemplative. I wanted something contemplated, something very
great.
Zen. So I decided to go with Subwars.
It's like the desire to play it was incepted upon you by Iwata himself.
Yes. Yeah, it was quite amazing. It was quite a formative experience. But it's interesting because, you know, it's free to play, right? So you download it. And it's kind of interesting seeing how Nintendo is approaching this, right? Well, first off, the game is strangely addictive. That's how I would call it. And I think, and
in spite of itself,
kind of like Enjoy Your Massage.
Yeah,
exactly like Enjoy Your Massage. Well, nothing is quite like Enjoy Your Massage, I should know. But Subwars is interesting because really no games out there, very few games do sub combat. So just that concept in itself is kind of strangely interesting. You know, it's certainly a slow-paced game. But it's kind of sort of a stealthy kind of combat. You know, I played a lot of the online, actually, more than I thought I would. Because, you know, it queues up fairly quickly, and you can find some games out there. You know, you have a choice between, you know, you can do the random battles where you're matched against anybody, so you inevitably wind up as a complete noob getting matched against people that are, like, level 60, and they have every submarine in the game, and which leads you to get your butt kicked most of the time. But yeah, I mean, I kind of enjoyed it. The single player really didn't hold my interest very long. I played the first couple of missions, and they were just sort of, you know, kind of boring.
Did you unlock the full version?
No, I didn't unlock the full version. But, you know, it's like kind of like a, you know, steer through these hoops kind of thing.
I was curious as to, you know, because most of these single players is locked if you get the free version. And I agree with you that the two missions that they do give you are not at all interesting and feels like they're way too long, and just really kind of boring. And I was curious as to whether maybe they get more interesting and more engaging in the later ones. And I read a few reviews and none of them really felt that they ramped up in any particular way. I mean, I think they give you a couple of different objectives and the environments might change a little bit, but they said the sense I got was that the other ones that you pay for and unlock are really kind of more of the same. And there are some differences in the multiplayer if you buy the game, which is interesting because it kind of creates maybe multi tiers of people who have paid and who have not, you know, but from what I've heard, it's actually balanced well enough that even people playing the free version can do pretty well if you actually know what you're doing.
Yeah, I don't know about that. I mean, I was getting my butt handed to me.
I mean, yeah, I felt out of my depth, you know, but sorry, I reused that pun, but I really did. I felt like, oh God, I have no idea what's going on or what I'm supposed to do here. And because you can't really directly communicate with the other players, there's not even really a way to ask your teammates, hey, I'm playing this for the first time. Can you kind of give me some tips or do you guys have a game plan here? You know, and that's really unfortunate. I mean, I know people like to joke about how, you know, you don't really need voice chat or, you know, that the Morse code is some kind of anything other than a novelty substitute. But you know, this is a team-based game. And moreover, it's kind of complex and not very intuitive. It's not like other games you played. It would be really nice if you could talk to the other people while you're playing it.
Yeah.
That's kind of important, you know? So I think that's unfortunate. I mean, the online play seems to work well, and I'm sure they have a ton of people playing it because it's free, but it's not really a complete experience without some kind of vocal communication, which has been standard in gaming for 15 years on most platforms.
Yeah, that's the thing. After playing online for a while, you realize that if you buy the premium, you know, version of the game, the submarines that you get are considerably better. And where it really gets you, I think, is they just have more, they have just more things to fire at you. So, you know, whereas the starter sub that you have has only 6 torpedoes, you know, they probably have, I mean, the next one up has 8. So I can only imagine what the ones have in the premium where, so they can just sit there and pretty much riddle you with torpedoes. And, you know, you have to sit there and you fire your 6 torpedoes and I think you have to wait for them to recharge. So it's considerable. I mean, it's pretty obvious that you have to, in order to compete, you have to get the premium version to really compete online because you'll be playing, like I said, 4 players that are like level 50 and above. And obviously they have all kinds of different subs. And so they can just, they pretty much smoke you pretty quickly. You have about 1 shot to take them out. And if you miss them, then they're coming after you. But it's pretty good. I mean, it's, I think the approach that they took is right in the sense that they had kind of an interesting gameplay, concept that was unique and kind of fun for really, like the games are really, really quick. So it's good for that kind of thing, right?
But it takes a long time to, you have to sit in the queue for like 2 or 3 minutes, don't you, before a game starts up?
Yeah, and I don't understand that because it
populates. Even when the queue is full, like you've maxed out on the players, everybody's there, everybody's ready, but you still have to wait for this counter to time down. I don't understand.
Yeah, I don't understand that either. It's just a time waster, and I don't know if that's something to cover up something that, you know, maybe slowness on their end and trying to do the matchmaking or something. I don't know.
Yeah, that seems likely.
Yeah, but I mean, am I going to, you know, unlock it for $10? No, I won't. I mean... And I say that, and you know,
even if you're enjoying it, you know,
that's the thing. It's like I realize that the concept itself, it's like there's only so far that they could take it, you know, before it just becomes kind of repetitive and stuff like that. And even the online multiplayer, I feel like, you know, they vary the size of the arenas that you're in. You know, some of them are large maps, some of them are like, you know, an oversized swimming pool kind of thing. But I feel like the type of combat you pretty much have a good idea of what it's going to be like just from the online multiplayer and the free version. So it's good, but not good enough to really make me bite on it.
Yeah, I feel the same way. Like it's interesting and I appreciate that they're trying weird things with it, you know, and trying to create a new franchise. That there's a lot to be said for them just, hey, we're not giving up on this thing. We know you didn't really like it the last time, but we're going to completely take it in a bizarre direction for the sequel. And and you know, see what happens, and maybe it works out for them. But I kind of feel like it's, I hate to be like this, because it's going to make me sound like a graphics snob, but I don't think the graphics in this game are good enough for the kind of thing, the kind of experience that it is. I mean, they're probably optimized for the online play, but I could see if this franchise continues, that, you know, if I had my druthers, I'd say, let's put it on Wii U, make it HD, make it a lot more colorful, you know, put in a lot more transparency effects and water effects, and turn it into more of like a Star Fox kind of a game, you know, or even like an Endless Ocean, maybe a little faster paced than Endless Ocean, but it really could be quite similar, and make it about either exploration in three dimensions as you're kind of going through weird environments and searching for sunken treasure or something, or make it a Star Fox game where it is combat focused, but it's from behind the sub perspective, you know, and you kind of are going in and out of weird coral formations and down into the trenches and, you know, chasing bosses, and make it more arcadey, and more of a graphic showcase. I think that would be really interesting. And probably have a lot more mass appeal than what they've done with it so far.
Yeah.
My first thought when I saw the trailer was, because I saw the characters, I thought, oh, okay, they're rolling it into the Advance Wars franchise with a subtitle, Sub Wars.
Mm. Oh, yeah.
That was the first thought that popped into my mind, but then it became clear that it was something else entirely.
Yeah, that seems very unlikely. I mean, to try to subvert another franchise is a good way to piss off a lot of people. It's been tried before with things like Bomberman Zero and even Star Fox Adventures. So I don't really think that would be productive.
Yeah, I mean, to your point about improving the environments, one of the things that is cool about the game is there is kind of a hide and seek element to it, where there's structures on the sea floor, you know, like kind of ruins sort of thing that you can hide behind, and that it would be cool for them to kind of expand that element of the game to the point where, you know, you can cloak yourself. I mean, you do have a cloaking device that you can cloak yourself for 10 seconds or something like that, but to have actually more of a hide and seek element to where you could ambush people, stuff like that would be really, really cool.
Can you destroy the priceless ruins? Because that was one of the highest points of the original. Just these things have been there for tens of thousands of years. Let's just blow it up.
I don't know. I haven't tried it. Usually, you know, that's because I'm typically running for my life.
They had been there for tens of thousands of years, but they were new when they started the development of the original Steel Diver. So,
hey-o!
Wow.
On that note.
Well, Billy, you probably played Steel Diver back in 2004 on the DS, didn't you?
Briefly.
Back at E3?
I played it at E3, and I was just like, not for me. And then it finally came out, and I was like, I just was not interested whatsoever. But I haven't downloaded this at all, but I'm curious after hearing John talk about it.
Hey, I mean, it doesn't cost anything to try it. That's the whole point. So,
are you contemplative, though?
Well, the one thing that was interesting was I went into the shop area to see how Peppy Hare was going to try to hard sell me on the game, and that's pretty funny because
he really doesn't, though. I feel like he's a very soft seller.
Yeah, he is. It's very much a soft sell, and it has kind of a Nintendo flavor to it, like sort of. It's just funny. It is a complete soft sell, but they're like, "Oh well, do you want to buy it? Oh well, if not, let me tell you some more.
Yeah.
Maybe you'll buy it." Kind of like, "I'm your buddy. Like, I'm your friend. Let me hook you up."
There's a weird trend of Nintendo soft selling you stuff via cartoon rabbits.
Yeah,
because it's the exact same narrative with the Mii Plaza.
Yeah, mm-hmm.
To the
different
point of
cartoon rabbits, though.
To the point of like, hey, I know you're not interested right now, but let's talk about it anyway. Is that okay? And you say no, and he's like, "Oh, okay. I'm sorry."
Yeah. When did bunnies turn into the merchant class of Nintendo?
I don't know.
I guess they are now.
And the best part though is if you say, "Well, actually, today we're having a deal," it's like, "Oh my god, stop it."
I also thoroughly enjoyed how the game tells you to take a break when you've been playing too long and come back later.
Oh.
It's like, what is that? What kind of a trend is that?
That killed me, especially because by the time I showed up, I thought, you know, I've spent at least 5 minutes of the game just waiting on the damn queue to, you know, to get going with an online match. So I really don't want to hear it. I don't want to hear your complaints about how long I've been playing when you make me sit around for no reason.
Play less.
Mm-hmm. Play less.
So, yep. not bad, but not biting.
All right, well, why don't we move on to what James has been playing this week?
I know last week we spoke, I'm not sure how much you've actually made the episode, of what would be a tornado of puzzles and pick arts. That would be my weekend. However, fate conspired, as it was wont to do, to prevent me from playing that game. So I have only got a few hours into the most recent and final Layton game, Professor Layton and the Azran Legacy.
Final?
Well, it is final. I mean, they've been pretty upfront with that. This is the final.
I mean, I don't really believe that, but...
That's what they're saying. This is the final Layton game.
Hey, remember when Superman died? Sorry.
I don't know. I mean, my guess is it's probably somewhat diminishing returns with that series right now anyway. I can't imagine it's moving units like Mysterious Village did.
And giving it a break is a good thing.
Anyway, so if you played the first 3DS Layton game, which I'm blanking on the title right now.
Miracle Mask?
Yeah. This game plays pretty much exactly the same as Miracle Mask. It has the same kind of weird drag the stylus around on the bottom screen to move it around on the top screen, then tap interface that game adopted to deal with the fact the 3D is on the top screen and the bottom screen is 2D, but has the touch screen. It works okay. I still kind of don't like how that feels. But besides that, from everything I could tell, it's a Layton game. It looks real nice. The character models seem somewhat... I know we said they looked good in the previous game, but after seeing the character models in Phoenix Wright's fifth game, I look at the ones they have now and go like, oh, these aren't that good.
They're okay, but they pale in comparison. I mean, it's just that Ace Attorney 5 looks so good, but it's also using, you know, I feel like the environments in that game are a little more static.
Oh, yeah, definitely. Because
as you move I don't know that they're made of polygons. I think there may be some in there, but as you move the magnifying glass around looking for hint coins and puzzles, the environment on the 3D screen shifts around. It's actually a really cool perspective kind of a thing, and Phoenix Wright doesn't do anything that complicated.
No, it just in some places the character models look a little bit low res.
Yeah, oh, I agree. I mean, in comparison, for sure.
Yeah, but still, the game looks good. It sounds good. I mean, ultimately, it's a Layton game. You know what you're getting into. I was a little surprised. The first five or six puzzles into the game are like one through six. I was a little surprised at the depth of difficulty they went in right away.
I agree.
I guess they feel like, oh, we can do this now because this is the 800th Layton game. But at the same time, it still felt the need to tutorialize everything. So I'm not entirely sure what the mentality was. Now, they weren't difficult, but they certainly were much, much harder than I expected from the opening salvo of the game. As I've gone through, I've sort of acclimated, so I'm not entirely sure if it's really pushing the difficulty more than previous games have. But at the very open, I remember being deeply surprised by what they brought.
Yeah, I mean, I was having to use hint coins like right off the bat, and I'm thinking, boy, was that rusty? I mean, this is the first one I've played in probably 3 or 4 years, but...
The very first puzzle, I would say, is probably a mid-game puzzle from the more recent Layton games. And that's, that's fine. I could deal with that. I was just a little surprised at how quick they went to that well. But, you know, I'm enjoying it. We'll see. You know, I liked Miracle Mask. I didn't love it. I didn't like the control scheme they put for the 3DS, but, you know, I got used to it. So we'll see how I feel about this one. Like I feel like Miracle Mask was a little bit... I mean, it was a 3DS launch game, even though it came out much later here. So I understand.
Right.
So I'm hoping that maybe this one gets it to where I really enjoyed from some of the later DS games.
Yeah, it's got at least 2 years worth of development time over... or at least, you know, I mean, the game came out about a year ago in Japan, but that still makes it way, you know, way newer and potentially more advanced than the last game, which you said was a launch title in Japan. So that game came out a long time ago.
Miracle Mask was at the E3 where they showed the 3DS the first time.
Yeah.
Yeah. I mean, that to give you an idea, it was there with Steel Diver.
Yeah. What was that, like 2009?
I think so, yeah.
Yeah. So.
Long time ago.
Yeah.
So we'll see.
All right. Well, I got the game too. I've played very little of it. Other things have gotten in the way this week, but I plan to spend lots of time with it. And for me, this is kind of like Pokemon or, you know, something like that, where it's like I pick up every third late in game or something like that. So it's been a while for me, but it is nice to jump back into that. And I didn't play the last one. So for me, the presentation on 3DS is really refreshing. It makes the game feel more exciting just to even to look at. And it's a series that I've always enjoyed the atmosphere of it. Presentation, the graphics are lovely, and the music is wonderful. So,
yeah, I skipped the last two, and I've been craving more Layton, but I'm mired. I'm bogged down by Bravely Default.
And, yeah, so
I played a lot of that too.
can we do a quick roundtable update on where people are at that? Because I know I mentioned I beat it.
I just started chapter 4.
Okay.
So I'm not yet at the part that everyone freaks out about. Yeah, I know.
Yeah.
But chapter 3 just wouldn't end, and I've stopped believing that this game respects players' time.
Chapter 3 is long.
Yeah. And like the end of chapter 3 is just a series of, okay, you go from point A to point B. Okay, no, go talk to that character at point A again.
It's very weird.
Go to point C to B, A, C, B, A. Like, it just made me run around these three places over and over again.
It feels very weird when it happens. Like, this is kind of odd.
Yeah. The progression just really gets kind of in a whirlpool, and I'm actually still in the middle of it. I'm still trying to finish chapter 3, and I feel like I've spent 20 or 30 hours in it at this point. I'm trying to do a lot of side quests. I'm getting to the point where some of the optional bosses that give you the new job classes are so difficult that I kind of got tired of trying over and over again, and finally I'm like, I'm just going to use summons. I'm just going to abuse the hell out of it.
Just switch. I mean, if you really just want to get it over with in that respect, just switch it to easy and just beat them.
Yeah.
You can do that in the middle of the quest, though.
Yeah.
You can switch.
Oh, yeah, and you can flip it right back up.
You know, honestly, like, the game is already – I've played it, I think, almost 40 hours, and I don't even feel like I'm very far. And I'm thinking that maybe – if I can do that, maybe I'll just play on easy the rest of the time. It's not that it's too hard. It's a little too time-consuming for me right now.
No, I mean, I absolutely did that when I was in chapter 6 and 7, just to get through them. And then when I went to chapter 8, which is the last chapter, and the game really tries to redeem itself hard there, you know, I dialed it back up. I strapped in and got ready for what proved to be a challenging conclusion to the game.
Okay.
But, you know, that got me through those chapters real fast.
Mm-hmm.
And I needed that at that point.
Yeah.
Whoa. Sounds very beaten down.
So my final save time, just for reference, completing the long version of the game, doing all the quests, and you get a bunch more quests as you go through the chapters. And getting both endings was roughly 75 hours.
Oh, jeez.
Wow.
Did you max out a lot of the jobs? Because that seems to really add
I maxed
on.
Out like 10 of them.
Okay. That's a pretty good number. And you unlocked almost all of them?
I unlocked all of them.
Whoa. There's a lot, aren't there? Aren't there like 30 jobs?
Something like that, yeah. So if you complete all the subquests in the first four chapters, you will have all the jobs. And beat the fourth chapter. You'll have all the jobs then.
So it's not like you keep getting them way late in the game.
No. You get them all at that point. Well, no, actually, no, that's not true. There's one you get very late in the game, but just one.
Well, I've only found maybe 6 or 8 of them, and it's not like, you know, you are strolling through the woods and you find a crystal and, hey, here we go. It's not like materia in FF7 or even...
No, there's icons on the screen saying, go here and do something.
Yeah, and it often turns into a 2 or 3 hour side quest ending in a very difficult and very particular boss fight that you kind of have to bring in kind of special tactics.
Yep.
Reminded me a little bit of some of the bosses in Chrono Trigger or even, you know, FF4, the hard version. And some of these are like I did one that made me go around the world on my boat to every single city I had previously been to. This was like a Ni No Kuni side quest, just like fucking busy work. And then I still had to fight a boss at the end. The whole thing probably took me 3 hours to get one of the worst jobs in the game.
Which one was it, as a curiosity?
The dancer, the performer.
Oh, yeah, that one.
Jeez, man. I'm getting to the point where I'm like, I like this game, but I don't have 100 hours to spend on this, you know?
So when I was thinking about the combat, the last few bosses can be real, not particular, but they've got skill sets that are real just maniacal, and you have to kind of manage them directly. And it got me thinking kind of like the boss battles in Radiant Historia, where the enemy does something and you need to have a strategy to mitigate it. Until you figure that out, grinding is not going to be your solution. So I kind of like that, but it does take some time to get there. So, happy hunting.
All right. Well, yeah, thanks. There's your Bravely Default update, your Bravely update. All right. So next up, why don't we hear from Guillaume, who's been playing an upcoming Wii U game.
Yeah, there was this event in Montreal, this kind of festival, where they had these 9 indie Montreal-based developers showcasing their games, and really there was only the one game that was coming eventually to Wii U, or at least I think it's coming. It's this game that was kickstarted, Anne is an acronym. And I don't know if people like it. It probably caught the attention a lot of Nintendo gamers first, because it did have a Wii U stretch goal, which it didn't reach, but who knows, like they might still make the port. And also, like, it's one of those games, like the guy was promoting it as a Metroidvania, and it's got a cute pixel art style, and you know, like lots of stuff like that, you know, probably would appeal to Nintendo gamers.
Do you feel like that is what it is now that you've played it?
Well, I played the demo, right? And the area that I've played, like the game, the part that he was showcasing was very similar to the area that he was showcasing on his Kickstarter video. But there are other trailers. Like I've seen that there are other areas in the game, and there are, you know, like it's not just because that's all of the game that exists. It's probably just because it's the most polished area. But yeah, like I got to play around. Like first he had this, he had people play on this, USB SNES inspired controller, which had the logo of the game on it. So I think this was like a Kickstarter reward for the bigger, backers. It felt like a third party controller. So sometimes I was having issues, properly, running or jumping in the game. And I wasn't sure, like, okay, is it because this is a crappy controller, or is it because, you know, the game is still coming together? But other than that, and other than a few camera problems, which, you know, happen from time to time, he's still polishing the game, it felt, you know, like it felt like a nice little 2D side-scrolling action-adventure. I haven't seen any evidence really that it's a Metroidvania game, like if in the sense like that I didn't see any evidence that you gain powers that allow you to kick more ass and also open up new areas of the levels. What I've seen instead, like I don't know, it was weird. Like you were collecting 4 logs to create a raft to go across a river. So it was more, you know, like kind of a Zelda type of thing, I suppose.
Quest based.
Yeah, like kind of quest-based. Another challenge that I had to do was try to make my way through an area to go unlock, to bring down a barrier that's blocking the ship. And I guess that's the most interesting thing about the game, the most interesting aspect, is that it's all one continuous world, but you can go inside this big ship, and when you go inside it, then the camera zooms out, and it kind of becomes a kind of a shmup, you know?
Whoa!
Wait, what?
It's an open world shoot 'em up?
Well, more or less. I think there are stages of, you know, shoot 'em up stages, but it's also mostly like kind of another tool that you can use to solve certain puzzles, and then you get out of the ship, and then you know, like you've just opened up the way. For instance, with the ship, you've got this tractor beam that you can use to pull up these gigantic blocks that you can't, as you know, the little character himself can't jump over, but then, you know, okay, just hop into your ship, move the block around, and then you can pass. So there's a lot of, you know, going back and forth between ship sections and on foot sections and
Okay, I just figured out what this game is. It's a tribute to Blaster Master.
Duh.
That's got to be where the name comes from, because in that game your tank is called Sophia, and it's all an acronym. And in this one it's called Anne, A-N-N-E, and it's all an acronym there. And what you're describing, I mean, it's a, with a ship instead of a, you know, spaceship instead of a tank, but it sounds very similar that you kind of have to go back and forth. Okay, I'm super excited about this game right now.
Yeah, it's kind of the same thing. And it's funny that, yeah, I hadn't made the connection because I think it's one of the few NES games that the guy doesn't mention in his Kickstarter video. Like, he's like, oh, yeah, I'm inspired
because
by...
Because he wants to hide the direct influence. He's like, oh, yeah.
But yeah, like, he mentions every NES game under the sun, and then, yeah, he leaves that one out.
Where's Waldo NES all up in this?
Rad Racer 2, obviously direct lineage.
Oh.
But yeah, like, so what I was playing was the PC build, of course, and he's mostly focusing on, you know, getting the game on Steam and Linux and, I don't know, OS X or whatever. And then, like, he's got a friend working on the ports, the console ports. Hmm. So there's no time, you know, there's no... Yeah, like, he had no idea when a Wii U owner could possibly play the game. And also, like, it sounded like he was having some issues, you know, like, the game, the guy has been developing games for 10 years inside, I don't know, probably at Ubisoft or something. But he's not a programmer, and he's using this third-party engine. He's kind of feeling his way around it. And so there were issues with the camera, as I mentioned earlier, and there was the sequence where I jumped into a hole, and then my character disappeared out of view, and I could still go left or right, and it was just...
That's a good bug.
Yeah, like, at that point, he was just like, you know what, I'm going to reset this for you.
That sounds like something that would happen in Mega Man 3 or something like that, Mega Man 4.
Yeah, and, you know, as a final note, I think... Well, first, like, I think that the demo didn't really completely win me over. Like, it didn't really, it felt right, you know, like, but I didn't really see, kind of the hook of the game. I felt like it's a nice little indie game that I'm probably gonna buy and play, but it didn't feel like Cave Story did, you know, the first time you play through that and you realize, okay, this is special. I didn't really get that from this demo. But also what really surprised me was, like, the reactions from people around me who were looking at, you know, other people play and just like, holy shit, is that an SNES game? You know, like, they were completely fooled just because of the controller and the fact that it's pixel art. But I, you know, in my head, I was thinking, are you morons? Like, this looks nothing like a Super Nintendo game. Are you crazy? Like, this whole, like, the little writing here that kind of recedes in the background while spinning, do you think that's Mode 7? You wouldn't be able to read it.
Well, I'm actually looking at their Kickstarter page right now, and one of the rewards, if you paid enough, you could get an actual, like, one of the cases is a Super Nintendo cartridge with the box.
Oh, yeah.
Like an instruction manual, and the controller too that you were talking about was also one of the rewards. So,
like, the game would be on the cartridge?
No, but they said I was just breezing through it, but I think they mentioned the fact that if they got enough money, they would make a prequel on an actual Super Nintendo cartridge. But I could be reading this wrong. But I think it's obvious the guy's a huge fan, you know.
Yeah, that was like the crazy mega stretch goal, like three times what he was asking for. But yeah, and like he had, like, on top of the TV, he had the fake SNES box, but if you look closely, it was not a Super Nintendo, but a Super Motendo, because it's games by Mo, he's Mo. Whatever. so wow. That's how I think he got a lot of people fooled. And it was just like, I don't know. I was thinking, as all these people were saying, oh, is this a Super Nintendo game? Just like, where have you guys been? Have you been playing any downloadable game in the past few years? This is not new. Like, there's so many pixel art games out there. I can't believe that this is a novelty still for some people. But I guess it is.
I think a lot of those are, like, really indie games, though, and not a ton of people play them. Like, we hear about them a lot, but we're, like, the prime audience for them. And I don't think they're, you know, especially because those never see retail, you know. I think there's probably a lot of people who have never seen a game that looks like Super Meat Boy, you know, or something like that.
Yeah, this, like, this was an event for the public, right? But even at PAX, I feel like people are more aware of these smaller games, you know? They're more aware that there's downloadable games out there.
They are, because PAX is very much about that. It's very much a showcase for that. But also, the people who go to PAX are not exactly the public.
No.
Right.
They're a very self-selected group. So, and, you know, unfortunately, we're not among them this year. But, you know, I think, no, those people are all pretty hardcore at PAX. That's why the indies love to go there, because they know that's their prime audience.
Right.
Well, plus, you know, instead of waiting 4 hours in line for, you know, a big AAA game, you can just rip in and out of the indie mega booth and see, like, 40 games, you know, and get your hands
on. And a lot of them are amazing.
Yeah.
Yeah, so look forward to that, although you're, you know, you're probably going to get it on PC way before you ever hear of a Wii U version.
Sure. Well, I'm excited to play it either way. Well, let's move on with new business. I can talk very briefly about some more Donkey Kong. I did not get a ton of time with it this week, and it's not because I didn't want to. It's just my situation didn't allow for it. I did play maybe a couple more hours. I played through all of the last world, World 6, which is when you go back to... that you finally make it home to Donkey Kong Island, where you were kind of banished from, and it's all frozen over. So it's actually probably the longest world that I've seen. I think it has the most stages, and the stages tend to be very long and very difficult, primarily because everything's covered in ice. And the boss, I'm still trying to beat him. I don't know that he's the boss of the entire game. I'm sure there's some bonus content or some kind of epilogue after this, but he's the boss you see in the opening intro. So he is the big bad of Tropical Freeze. And he is a real bastard. It takes forever. Just to revisit one of my comments from last week, I'm not sure I fully expressed myself about the boss battles, but one reason I'm finding them really kind of irritating, although they're cleverly done, but they are very long. And the reason they're very long is because they're heavily scripted, and the bosses go through this cycle of patterned movements, and usually they're only vulnerable for one of those. And so you get one chance to attack. If you miss, you just lost your chance, and they're going to go back into the next attack cycle. And during most of the attack cycle, you can't hurt them at all. And so the whole thing takes a finite amount of time. It's got to drive speedrunners crazy, you know, because these bosses take forever, even if you're amazing. And for the rest of us, for us normal people playing the game, it's just exhausting. And they're very difficult, and there's no checkpoints. I mean, even Bit Trip Runner 2 has checkpoints during the bosses, and they're a godsend. Right. This game, it's like the whole boss fight might be 8 or 10 minutes long of some of the most difficult gameplay in the entire game. And if you make a mistake towards the end, you have to start over from the beginning. And even if you find the first half of the boss fight very easy, it still takes forever to get through because it's so scripted. It's an irritant to me. I really dislike that.
But I think that just by playing around in co-op, like, we were less afraid of dying, because as long as one of us was still alive, then we could keep fighting the bosses.
That's probably the biggest benefit of playing in co-op in this game, is the bosses, because of that.
But also, like, while playing around, like, we discovered a lot of alternate ways to actually damage the bosses. Like, there were times when it looked like, oh, it doesn't look like he's attacking. It doesn't look like we can actually jump on him at this point, but we could. And I'm kind of wondering, like, if you find enough of these alternate ways that perhaps, like, the boss battles can actually be pretty short. You know, like, for instance, the underwater fish one, at some point he spews a smaller fish at you, and if you can hit them just right, you're going to send them on it, and then all of its defenses go down, and he's much easier to hit at that point. And also the one with the monkeys swinging around, you can actually damage them while they're swinging, and it doesn't really look like you can, you know, at first glance.
Yeah, I know what you mean, and I think those are there for some of the bosses, and they're not for others. The one I'm on, he spends most of the time in the background, so you can't even access him without throwing something.
Okay.
And the opportunities to throw something are very limited because you throw enemies that he sends to you.
Right.
So it's just, anyway, that's getting a little too specific, but it is a very tough game. I have problems with it. I don't particularly like the controls. But it is pretty, and the music actually, I think, gets better and better the deeper you go into the game. So it's a good carrot. It certainly is motivating me to want to keep going and see some of the later stuff, some of the hidden stuff. So I will keep playing it for sure.
Yeah. Just before you move on, there is a way to switch the freaking face buttons without changing the whole control scheme. You just press minus or plus during the it's weird, but there is a way. So errata, I guess.
Yeah, I was actually, when I played it last night, I you know, remember that you had tweeted about finding that or emailed, and I was like looking for it as I set up the game, and I still never saw any kind of explanation of it or any indication. So it's like a secret code almost to swap the buttons, I think.
I don't understand it.
Yeah, me neither. Anyway, the other thing I wanted to talk about, I didn't get to play this nearly enough either, but it only came out yesterday, or I only got it yesterday, and that is South Park, The Stick of Truth.
Ooh, I want to hear about this.
I've only played it for maybe an hour or two. I wanted to get in some time with it before this show, and I've been looking forward to this for a while. Didn't know a ton about it. I knew that it's kind of a Paper Mario-style RPG, so a little shorter, more comedy-based, relatively simple turn-based battle system with some active time battle elements, and maybe a reduced level of character customization complexity in terms of gameplay. Maybe not 1,000 different weapons and armor to equip, but maybe a little bit simpler system. And I knew that Matt and Trey, Matt Stone and Trey Parker were heavily, heavily involved with the development, which is worrisome in a sense, because those guys are not game developers and don't necessarily know what they're doing. But in an RPG, you know, the appeal is so largely heavily based on the story that I felt, well, you know, even if the game plays poorly, if those guys are really in on it and they really care about the outcome, the sky's the limit on how good this could be. And that's kind of how it's played out mostly. I mean, there's some complaints about it, but I think most people who've played it really do enjoy it and say that, you know, they love the story, they love the humor of it. If you're a South Park fan, if you're not, obviously stay away from this. I mean, I think after 15 years, most people can tell whether that's something that they like or not. For my money, it's a show that I've never been able to watch consistently. My access to Comedy Central has kind of come and gone many times over the years, so I never was able to really latch onto it on a weekly basis or really get into it that way. But I've always absolutely adored the show. I think it's one of the best TV shows ever made, it's coming up on nearly 20 years old now. So that they can do something like this really late is like, you would think it might be kind of really crappy license schlock, but As we all know in South Park, that all happened really early, and then they gave up on trying to do video games for a long time, and now they finally come back and try to do it the right way. And I think they really did. I mean, the coolest thing for me, and what you notice immediately when you start playing the game, is that it looks exactly like the TV show. And that sounds simplistic, maybe, or just obvious, but when you're playing it, it really is so striking that, you know, if you're not next to something you can interact with, for instance, where if you're not in a situation where a button prompt might come up or where they might be displaying something because it's relevant, they actually keep the UI very clean. And so most of the time when you're playing the game, you're just walking around or looking at things. It looks literally exactly like the TV show. If someone walked in, they would not be able to tell the difference. And it is so immersive in a game that doesn't even seem like it should be possible for it to be immersive. It looks like it's made of construction paper. How could you possibly put yourself in this world? And that's not really what I'm doing, but what I'm doing is I'm putting myself in the mood of as if I'm actually watching it on TV, you know? So it's a very strange kind of fan service because it's almost like one medium tricking you into feeling like you're experiencing it through another medium. It's very strange. And of course, it's still interactive and it's still a video game, but it is the most TV show like video game ever made. I can tell you that. And that's a weird honor, but I love it. I adore it. In a lot of ways, it reminds me of the movie because the movie also really did look exactly like the TV show. They didn't try to make it crazy CG pretty version or anything like that. They said, no, this is the style. We're going to keep this. It will just be a different, longer version of it. And that's exactly what it was. So if you're a South Park fan, this seems like a no-brainer. I mean, it's certainly not broken. It's certainly not bad. And if you like the show, you're gonna really appreciate this.
What's the combat like?
It's exactly like Paper Mario.
Okay.
You know, there's some different rules about status effects and things like that. There's a little bit of a paper, rock, scissors. I guess even that you know, Paper Mario has with the hammer and the jumping. The similar thing about characters who have ranged attacks and who have armor and stuff like that. But it's very simple, it's fun so far. The timing on defensive moves is really tight, maybe even tighter than Paper Mario. But I think they do that because otherwise it might be overpowered.
Super curious. I really want to play it.
Yeah, Johnny, I was just asking about the story. Obviously it's silly and sarcastic and everything, but I mean, is there anything particularly striking about it or anything that surprised you?
It's incredibly offensive, as you would hope for, but they certainly didn't hold back just because it's the video game version. It is, if anything, you know, more abrasive, more offensive than the TV show because it's uncensored. You know, you've got in the opening scene, Cartman says fuck all over the place. And that really struck me. I just didn't see it coming because I'm used to thinking of the TV show as a TV show where they can't do that. But obviously in an M-rated video game, you know, why not?
Wasn't it like something happened, like it was banned in Germany because they used swastikas?
I don't know. I haven't seen that.
The EU version is apparently there's like four scenes that are cut out, and their response,
they don't like anal probes over there.
Wow. That was the first episode of the show. I mean, South Park and anal probes go hand in hand, you know.
No pun intended.
The response is basically just, hey, it's a screen that has the EU flag and the thinker with text going, hey, Europe, they wouldn't let us do this scene. Here's a description of the scene. And it just makes you sit there while the scene would have been playing.
That's pretty awesome.
And there's like four of them. So it's like, hey, it's me again. I couldn't show you this scene because this happens. And they describe it.
I appreciate the satirical solution there, but it also seems like it's punishing the consumer a little bit, who I'm sure would love to see that stuff and is not allowed to. I don't know that that's how I would have handled it, but no, thankfully I live in the land of the free and the home of the brave, and I get to see South Park in all its glory, and it's pretty shocking. I mean, my character is a Jew class. One of the first things you see in the game is you get to create your character, and it's like fighter, mage, thief, and Jew. And I was like, well, I mean, I have to pick that. And it's they go all out, man. It's crazy. So
what qualities does a Jew have?
Oh, well, I'm afraid.
I mean, it's a noble class. It's you know, it's up there with fighter and mage. It's like maybe a red mage would be a good description based on what I've seen so far. I haven't unlocked many of the abilities, but it seems to have both physical and magical attacks, whereas the other ones are a little more, you know, one or the other. So it's kind of a well-rounded, I think, class. But I can't say for sure because a lot of it will come out in the special abilities and you have special equipment. So I bought a staff that looks like a shepherd's crook cane, you know, and that was my starting weapon. So the jokes that they set up early, you know, they have to be carried through the game because all these related items and magic spells and things, they all connect back to that stuff early on. So there is a little bit of setup. It takes a while for them to teach you the combat system, but I'm out. It's very open right now. I mean, the world is the town of South Park, and you go left to right, screen to screen, exactly like they do in the show, to get around to different levels. And there's a map that shows you how all these things connect, and you go from house to house, completing quests and fighting battles along the way. And it's crazy. It's a lot like the quest for the tape, you know, when they did the Lord of the Rings spoof and they had the porno tape and they were, you know, sort of dressed up in costume and going around town and encountering bullies and different gangs and telling, you know, mythologies to each other. Very, very similar setup for this game. So it really is like playing a long episode of the TV show, and it's freaking crazy.
I need to play this.
I'm excited to spend a lot more time with it this weekend.
Yeah, it sounds really funny.
All right, guys. Well, let's come around to Billy.
Yeah, so I actually I hadn't been playing a lot of games for a while just because I was really busy with life and work and that sort of stuff. But one that fell like out of my radar was the NES Remix release for Wii U. And so I finally ponied up for that and gave that a whirl. And it's fun. It's neat. It's really fast. I mean, I don't know. I'm sure you guys have talked about it, but it's just quick hitting NES games. Very, very much in the vein of like a WarioWare kind of thing where you get challenges and in a bunch of different NES games. I kind of wish it was more of a party game, but which is seems weird for me to need like have a need for another party game for a Nintendo console, but like it seems like it would really lend itself well.
It'd be nice if it had a party mode.
Yeah, like you could just pass the controller back and forth, you know, with a buddy on the couch or something like that. But it's neat. It's fun. It's surprising after how many iterations of WarioWare there have been that it took this long for them to make something like this. It seems like a no-brainer. And
they only now achieve the emulator technology with which to accomplish this dream.
Well, it's basically like they one day just admitted, hey, 9-volt stages are really good. Let's just make a bunch of them.
Yeah. So, I mean, it's fun. I mean, for $15, I think it's, I don't know how much longevity it is. I've barely scratched the surface on it, but just kind of farted around with it today, and it's fun. It's neat. I'm surprised it took, as I said, I'm surprised it took them this long to come out with it. But actually what I've been really playing a lot of lately since it came out last week is Plants vs. Zombies Garden Warfare. I'm playing it on Xbox One. And
well, you would have to be, right?
Currently, yes. Cause I think it's coming to 360 later. But anyway, so it just came out. It's from PopCap. And if you know anything about Plants vs. Zombies, picture that world in a third-person shooter. And it's all multiplayer. So there is no like main single player campaign. It's only $40, which is kind of nice. Which is also interesting too, which I'll come back to later. But, you know, so it's $40. And there's a few modes. There's not like a whole variety of modes. You have your general, you know, your kind of your Slayer, you know, just versus team mode or, you know, that sort of thing. But then they've got their version of like a horde mode, which is called Garden Ops, which is the one of the two modes that I play the most of. And that's just four players, where you have wave after wave of you play as the plants, and you get wave after wave of zombies coming at you. But what's neat is it kind of mixes tower defense, so you get these stickers, as they call them, in the beginning of the game, you buy a sticker pack, and within the sticker pack, you get a bunch of different stickers that are either plants or zombies or different like power-ups or things like that. So when you go into Garden Ops, you'll see planters in strategic areas, and this is where you can, it's kind of a tower defense thing where you can set up some of the different plants like as like a turret or something like that to help fend off, you know, the oncoming enemies.
And that's a little closer to the original Plants vs. Zombies, which was a tower defense game.
Right. And so, I mean, it all stays within the universe, which is, it's neat how they did it. So in Garden Ops, there's like 10 waves. And as you can guess, like, you build a garden in the beginning, and then the waves begin, and there's time between each wave, so you can go, you know, replenish the planters or, you know, just get your defenses set up. And, you know, there's different player classes. So like on the plant side, you have your pea shooter and your chomper and your sunflowers and things like that. And they all have different attributes and things that they can do and heal you. Like the sunflower, obviously you can heal other people, but like I stuck mainly with just the pea shooter because you actually level up your characters, and then it has like different character customization and all that sort of stuff. So it's actually relatively deep for $40. There's not a ton of modes. The other mode that I really like a lot is the Gardens and Graveyards mode, which is the team based shooter section of the game. So what you're trying to get as the zombies, you're trying to take over all the gardens. And on the other side, on the plant side, that you're trying to protect certain areas.
And it's asymmetric, right? Like, the zombies aren't clones of the plants. They play very differently.
Yes, they do. And so, like, you have foot soldiers or engineers, like the all-star, like the football player, you know, different characters that you know from the games. And so, this I started playing a couple days ago just because I wanted to try something different from Garden Ops. And as zombies, like, that's the part that I really enjoyed because there's, like, little patches of ground that you can go and, you know, use your zombie cards as well. So you can summon different, like, bucket heads or the guy that wears the traffic cone or, you know, et cetera, et cetera, and to take over these different, vantage points. And it's really charming. It's really addictive. It's a very solid shooter. I'm impressed. I mean, it's using DICE's Frostbite engine, so, I mean, it's got good chops. I mean, it's not like really pushing the Xbox One too hard. I think the frame rate is pretty solid. And now that they've got the servers under control, like, it's pretty good. So I think it's a lot of fun. I think it's gonna be interesting to see what happens when Titanfall comes out next week, to see if that player base stays. However, what is nice about it is even though it is, a third-person shooter, I mean, this is a perfect game for kids, too. Like, it's not gory, it's not bloody, it's not extremely violent, and it's cute, but there's a solid game there, so I really think it's a lot of fun.
Yeah, I mean, I hate to be that guy, but I gotta say, this is the kind of game that I might pay $20 for. Just, you know, I mean, I would enjoy the multiplayer. I would definitely try it out since that's clearly the focus. But without some kind of campaign, that's where I would expect to spend most of my time. And I think, you know, the number of maps and modes it has is not super impressive for a retail game. You know, it's coming out a week or two before Titanfall, which I think is already gonna have to, they're gonna have to hard sell that to justify, you know, $60 for a game that's only multiplayer. I think the amount of content that's in it and the sophistication of, you know, the weird kind of gameplay that Titanfall has, I think they can make that argument. They can say, look, this is something very new. You've never played anything like it. You need to trust us that it's worth the full price. And if they can get reviewers on board with that, it might work. But this game seems like something that, you know, back a couple years ago would be seen as really kind of a premium download title, you know, for Xbox Live Arcade. This would be like a $15 or $20 game, I think. So I think the reason it's $40 is because it's on the new system and it costs more to make, but not, it doesn't seem necessarily like the kind of thing that really stands out from a lot of the other download games that we get nowadays. I mean, even free-to-play games, you know, are not that different from the gameplay model here.
Yeah, I mean, my understanding is that there is DLC that's coming that is they're not actually going to charge for. So at least if they pad it out more, I think that'd be awesome.
So that sounds like they released half the game because they wanted to get it out before Titanfall.
That sounds reasonable.
it's very curious just because they spaced the two. A, because it's from the same publisher, too, which I thought was a little odd that they're spacing these two shooters on Xbox One, you know, 2 weeks apart.
It is, in fact, extremely odd.
I would be concerned, but, like, I mean, that being said, you know, for what I paid for it, you know, I'm really liking it. Like, I'm having a lot of fun with it. I think there's a lot of depth to it that I have barely even touched because I've only played just the two base classes. Like, I haven't even messed around with the other classes yet, and because you level each of them up, and so I've been just focusing on trying to get my pea shooter up as high as possible and my foot soldier on the zombie side, you know, just to see what I unlock and things like that. I think I would like these because I've put a couple hours in already. I would like to see little faster progression, maybe. Like, I don't know if they need to have it at such a, for you to take so much time to level your character up and to unlock new abilities. I think it might be in their best interest to, like, speed that process up a little bit more. But that being said, you know, if you like PvZ and you like that world and you also like shooters, I think this is a great game. I think it's really, really a lot of fun.
Yeah, now that you mention it, I mean, because it's not even just the two teams, but every character has their own abilities and play style. It sounds actually maybe something closer to Team Fortress 2, which, you know, is really popular and a really good game. But, you know, that was part of the Orange Box way back in the day. And when they released Team Fortress 2 on its own, I think it was originally $20 or $30. Now it's free to play. So that just to reinforce my point, but not to say this is bad. It actually sounds really good. And I think from what I saw the trailer at E3 last year at the EA press conference. But I from the very beginning, I know a lot of people were hating on this and thought it was a stupid idea, but I took one look at it and said, they nailed that art style in 3D. Those characters look fantastic. And I think that alone would be enough to get me interested in playing it, because I do like the original Plants vs. Zombies. And I thought just a cartoony looking shooter like this is so unusual. You so rarely see that. And, you know, the fact that it's class based and all these different, characters and teams are so different, that does make it way more interesting for sure.
Yeah, it's definitely fun, but I do know that the second Tuesday rolls around, I am jumping ship to Titanfall. I played the heck out of the beta and loved it. I just really, really had a lot of fun with it. And that worries me for this game. But, you know, as I said, the thing that is really great about it is the fact that you can kids can play this too. So this is a great title for them as well.
John, I know you being an online shooter guy, Titanfall has to pull at you a little bit.
It does.
It piques my interest, and I'm much less of a fan of that stuff than you. It doesn't nearly pique my interest to the tune of $500, but it certainly is something I'm keeping an eye on.
Yeah, I'm definitely – I don't think that I haven't thought about, you know, dipping $500 on that bundle. Mm. But, you know, that's – the thing is with Xbox One is that I feel like time is on my side with that. Because,
oh boy!
Oh,
yes.
Absolutely!
I mean,
it is.
It's kind of like, yeah, I could buy it for $500 now, but I mean, the thing is, I'm already seeing bundles where, I mean, not the Titanfall bundle, but just other things where, you know, hey, buy one and get a free copy of Ghosts or a free copy of Battlefield 4. So, the bundling has already begun, and it's going to continue. And so, I'm just kind of sitting back with popcorn and seeing what happens.
I'm kind of hoping at some point they debundle it from Kinect.
Yeah, I don't think that's going to happen.
Then the prices would really drop, but, you know, I know people hate that idea too. They say it's, you know, it's kind of like taking the gamepad out of Wii U. It really kind of destroys the one thing that gives that system an identity. And I appreciate that as well. But actually for me, I'm kind of just waiting for Titanfall 2, which I think will come out on PS4. Then I'll be fine.
Yep.
Have either of you played it? Just curious.
No, I wish. No.
I have not. Nope.
Nope. And I don't have a PC that could play it either, or even a 360 at this point.
It's believe the hype. Like, I saw it at E3 and I was just like, holy crap. And then at PAX Prime last year, I got my hands on it. And just the variety of combat that just having those two, you know, soldier versus being in a Titan, or, you know, really affords you, it's just really fun. And just the verticality of all the levels and being able to just ping pong between buildings and hop on stuff, like, you can rip. It's just amazing. The variety of movements that you can do that really switch up just the whole concept of a shooter. It's really a lot of fun.
I think I still have my CD of Shogo Mobile Armor Division somewhere.
Holy God!
Whoa, deep yep. Pool.
Oh.
Yeah, well, I talked about Attack of the Titans a few weeks ago, and I'll tell you right now, if they did a DLC pack where you could turn your Titan in Titanfall into one of the Titans from that anime series, I would probably go buy an Xbox One for that.
But that would have to require both EA or Microsoft care about Japan right now.
Right, yep. Right. No, it's not happening, but it would be awesome. Well, that's going to wrap up our new business. It's nice we ended on a nice discussion about online gaming, because when we come back, we're going to have our special feature on Nintendo online gaming from the year 2004 through 2014. Nintendo Wi-Fi connection is going away. So we're going to take a look back at our memories, all the weird stuff that happened, and the fun games we played on Nintendo Wi-Fi connection.
Or tried to play.
Here's a quick look at the best original content at our website, now playing at NintendoWorldReport.com.
First up this week, we have an interview, Moon Chronicles, with Renegade Kids' Jules Watcham, by our own Johnny Metz and Brian Rose. We got to talk about Moon Chronicles, and most pressingly, Razer Global Domination. Razer World Report has all the exclusive details.
Haha.
We also have a review of Castle Storm, From Outcast to Savior, the Castle Storm DLC by Curtis Bonds. Welcome to the future, Nintendo gamers. Now you can pay for DLC. Outcast to Savior is an add-on to Castle Storm, and Curtis likes it a lot. So if you enjoyed Castle Storm, you probably already bought it, but you can still read Curtis's review. We aren't going to stop you.
All right, and we also have a review for Tepingo on the 3DS eShop by Don Koopman. Waiting for Picross 90? Maybe you should check out unpronounceably named Tepingo. It's a puzzle game hybrid. I'd describe it, but Don includes video, so go watch that instead.
Good idea.
Dropping you to the site.
Next up, we have a feature, Nintendo Collector's Journal. You know it, you love it, by Justin Berube. Each week, Justin has documented his descent into madness. Justin traveled into the halls of temptation, the Nintendo World Store. Included in this week's video, a ton of metal drink canisters with Nintendo art.
Cuz.
And last but not least, there's a feature on Nintendo World Report of Nerds and Men Reluctance by Zach Miller. Zach has finally decided to explore the digital side of game purchases, thanks in part to Pokemon Bank. Read his exhaustive discussion on the mental processes driving him towards an all-digital future.
Again, and thanks to Pokemon Bank.
And boobs, probably.
And no Topanga. I mean, Topingo.
Topingo.
Billy, you read that like you have experience with cue cards.
Yes.
Oh, beautiful.
We have a true professional on hand, guys.
Yeah, it's better than you schmucks.
I had to make a Topanga reference.
I have no idea how to pronounce the name.
Buy Topanga today.
Topingo?
I'll tell you. By the time you hear this, there might also be some special features on the site regarding a certain anniversary, but we'll save that for later. Anyway, go check out all of this original content and much more over at NintendoWorldReport.com.
Topinga.
Welcome back, everyone. It's time for our feature discussion on Nintendo Wi-Fi connection. A lot of memories. We've spoken about it many, many times on this podcast, although not recently, for obvious reasons, but in the early days, the early years, meaning like up through maybe the fifth or sixth year of this podcast, it was a popular topic, and the games that we played on it were popular topics. So, not any new ground here, but I feel like we never really took a really hard look at the service overall, and now it seems like a great time. It's shutting down in mid-May, and, I think the fact that there hasn't been an enormous outcry of anger or grief over this says a lot about the service. But it is still, I mean, for 10 years, the past 10 years, it has been allowing Nintendo gamers to play online, which was a dream of my childhood. So it is a significant period in Nintendo's history, and a lot of interesting experiences came out on it. So I know all five of us have spent plenty of time dealing with the service and the games that we played on it. Dealing with, I think, is a fair term to use there. It's never been completely smooth or rosy, but not to say it's all been negative either. Now, for the rollout back in 2004 of this service, the very first Nintendo Online games of the modern era, I'm not talking about weird old Famicom or Satellaview stuff, but of the modern era were Mario Kart DS and Tony Hawk. So that was, I think, Tony Hawk's American Skate Land. I think, yep. I reviewed it or something. It's a very LA. Fuzzy memory.
Yep.
But yeah, so what do you guys think? How did, you know, the early days, we were pretty excited about this, especially for Mario Kart, of course. And I'm sure all of us messed around with it. What did you guys think back then of playing Mario Kart online for the first time?
I'm going to be very cynical right out the bat, but Mario Kart DS was kind of like the first sign of that maybe online wouldn't go the way I wanted it to go, just because it was super fun until snaking happened. And then I just sold the game. And there was always some little thing, or sometimes some bigger things in pretty much every online Nintendo game that I've played that made me just like, you know what, I don't want to deal with this, and there's never going to be a patch, so, you know, goodbye game.
Yep. Yeah, it was pretty obvious that it was all kind of slapped together, and, you know, it was all done through GameSpy, so, you know, you kind of wondered what the service was going to be like.
Did we want to reminisce about the good times first? I'm sorry.
No, I think starting with the origin story is probably the appropriate thing to handle. So this is a reboot of Nintendo Wi-Fi Connection. We're going to go with the origin story first. So I actually didn't have Wi-Fi at home when this came out.
Let me pause you there, because I think this is important for the context. If people weren't gaming back in 2004, don't really remember this period very much. Back in 2004, Nintendo DS was one of the first widespread consumer devices to get Wi-Fi support. This was not a very common thing. This was before smartphones primarily.
Right.
This was before, you know, your Vitas and your tablets and iPods. I mean, this was before iPods went on the internet. 2004. Okay. This was before podcasting existed. People didn't necessarily have Wi-Fi in their homes. And that was, I think, a big concern. And so a lot of the marketing around the rollout of Nintendo Wi-Fi Connection was where you could use it. It was, hey, go to McDonald's. We set up a special deal with your Best Buys and things like that. Public libraries. I remember going to websites and looking at maps of places where I could go and actually try to use their Wi-Fi because I'd never needed to before. I didn't own a laptop.
And they also released the USB connector.
So I was going to talk about that. Talk about that device because I actually had one.
I still have one somewhere.
I had like a review version of it. I don't think I needed it or paid for it, but I was like testing it out for the site.
So, yeah, the Buffalo Wi-Fi adapter, they had to stop selling them for different reasons. But I think ultimately the real reason was they just weren't a necessary product anymore.
Mm-hmm.
But the device was real weird. So it was a device you plugged into your Windows XP PC. Remember, very specific.
Yeah.
That was hooked up to a broadband internet connection that effectively created this sort of secondary kind of wireless internet that's not Wi-Fi because other Wi-Fi devices couldn't see it.
Was it AOS?
It worked really badly. It's kind of amazing that they would release an accessory intended to do one very specific thing.
It actually worked well enough that I was able to use it not just for my DS but for my Wii when it came out, because I didn't actually have Wi-Fi till like 2007.
I never got it to work very well.
If I was in the same room as it.
I was right near mine, so mine always worked pretty well. I knew enough not to try to stretch its capabilities, let's put it that way.
Yeah. But what's goofy was the setup for that was actually my most vivid memory of it. So I plugged it into my PC first and then went to install the disk. And it goes, I have the drivers for this. Don't worry about it. I got it. And I'm like, oh, cool. And then it didn't work. And then I read the instructions like, do not plug this in first. So I have no idea what kind of drivers that thing installed on Windows directly, but I had to do a freaking system restore to do this thing again.
It says a lot, James, that it was a USB device that came with a CD that you had to install drivers from.
Yeah,
that is the era that we're dealing with here. I mean, it really was a long time ago. It was almost 10 years ago.
The first time I played Mario Kart Online was I was a freshman in college, I guess. 2004. So actually, I got
but a babe, a teenager, James Jones.
I would have actually. I was probably still in high school when it came out, but first time I played it online, I was in college. It was my first semester, and I couldn't connect it to the building Wi-Fi because our building Wi-Fi required you to go to a website and click the "I agree" like it's hotel internet.
Right.
Mm-hmm. And the DS just couldn't handle it. Just couldn't. So
it didn't have a browser.
It didn't. I went to a public Wi-Fi space in a park that is the creepiest park in the world, just right off a campus, because there's no light seems to penetrate beyond the trees, and tried to play Mario Kart there. That is what the Wi-Fi connection was like in 2004.
So you got mugged for Mario Kart is what you're saying.
I only played one race, let's put it that way. And then I returned and said, yeah, I don't need that. I can live without Mario Kart. But it worked, I think, was the thing that surprised me more than anything. Was that it just seemed to kind of work. Not well, but at all. I think it was surprising.
Billy, I know you are a big Mario Kart fan, but I also know that by the time this thing rolled out in 2004, you were away from our website. I was running it at the time, and you were over at Game Informer, and so you weren't necessarily as compelled or as immersed in Nintendo as you had been back when you were running our website. How big, I mean, what was your sense of the, you know, the level of hype around this, and what was your level of interest in that of the professional games media people around you?
I don't think my interest, like, waned at all. Like, I was still, you know, we're finally getting to play Mario Kart Online. Like, that's a big deal, you know, and
yeah,
there were a couple other, you know, games that were going to come out that I thought would be really interesting, like Animal Crossing. That was another use of the Nintendo Wi-Fi setup. And like, I'll agree with Guy, like, you know, snaking just totally ruined that game for me. So if I was playing with friends, that's one thing. But then even just setting that up alone wasn't the easiest feat. You know, and I think anybody was excited about that sort of thing. I mean, having a portable device with Wi-Fi, I mean, the PSP also had it too. And being able to play games online, like, it just was really becoming a thing a lot more, in 2004. Geez, you know, I mean, it was, you know, the PC had been doing it forever. You know, that was the first thing that, but, you know, for consoles, especially Nintendo consoles, I mean, Christ, I had the broadband adapter for GameCube, and I remember playing Phantasy Star Online and just being excited, even though that game was a Dreamcast game that you could play online. You know, I mean, you know, yeah, finally having a Nintendo console that you could take online and play games was a pretty big deal, especially with such a big title like Mario Kart. You know what I'm saying? So,
well, and I had played Double Dash, Mario Kart Double Dash online through the Warp Pipe.
Oh, yeah.
I don't know if you guys remember this, but it was a real pain in the ass to set up, and it did not work very well. There was a ton of lag and a lot of disconnections, and I did it for the novelty. You only used it a few times. And sadly, it was one of the only things I ever did with that, network adapter, because I didn't really play, Phantasy Star. A little bit of the third one, for review, I think, but, I just, you know, I gotta say, like, the rollout of Mario Kart DS, with all the problems that that game had and with all the weird setup crap that went with Nintendo Wi-Fi connection, it was a huge step up from using Warp Pipe on Double Dash, because it was actually, you know, kind of built for it. And it didn't work great, but it worked well enough, you know, and it really was a magical thing. I mean, you know, even though GameCube did have that network adapter, Nintendo never supported it. Not for online gaming. That you could do LAN in a couple of games, which is how Warp Pipe, they hacked into that and put it out over the internet. But
yeah,
Nintendo never did an online game for GameCube.
Yeah, it's true. It's true. And which is so bizarre that the company that did it was Sega, and they put out two games, and they were both the Phantasy Star games. So, like, really? It's... So, like, but that was, like, exciting. It was, like, finally. And, yeah, it was... You know, it was a little janky. You know, that's where the whole friend codes thing really got to be a pain. And, you know, we were getting used to the concepts of, well, like, parties and being able to, you know, it just, you had to always, didn't you always have to, like, restart? Like, if once the game was over, then you'd have to do everything
all the way
again.
Back out.
Yeah.
All
yeah,
the
yeah.
way back out. Yeah.
So, like, you know, but I was also excited, like I said, Animal Crossing. That one I was super psyched for because, you know, you could finally visit other people's towns. And yeah. But you would have to leave your gates open. And I remember, I remember this is when I was still at GI, and we got early copies of Animal Crossing. So the only people that had them were probably press at that time. And I remember I played against my buddy Stephen Fairley, who lives in Australia. Actually, that's one of Costa's friends. Go way back to Planet GameCube. And I'm still friends with him today. But so because he was in Australia, the time difference was so huge. And so I remember telling him to leave his gates open. And he's like, yeah, I'll leave a gate open, and then I'm going to bed. And so I went and just wrecked his town. Like, I chopped down all of his trees, and I dug holes everywhere. I was totally that guy, and I've never done that.
And that's
since.
How the Great War between America and Australia began. Yes. Back in 2005.
Awesome.
And that was because you were saying your greatest memories of the Nintendo Wi-Fi connection. I would say that is definitely one of mine, just because I was a total dick in Animal Crossing, and I've never done that since. And he laughed about it. He thought it was hilarious. But yeah, I mean, between that, I didn't really use it a lot on the Wii. Outside
except
of
for Monster Hunter,
Monster
right?
Hunter, and using it.
Well, maybe we should table that, because I think that's a larger discussion to be had. Maybe we could kind of keep on your theme there of some of your favorite memories of playing a game over the service. I mean, mine would probably be on Wii, and I think it would be GoldenEye. I think that was maybe the most fun. I mean, I played The Conduit as well, but
eight and a half, baby.
Not so great.
8.5.
Yeah, the campaign actually might be the best thing about The Conduit, and that's that tells you a lot. But with GoldenEye, that is a extremely high quality Wii game all around. The single player campaign is also very good, although I have deep problems with, especially the final boss is just asinine.
Oh, yeah. Yeah, it's dumb.
But the online multiplayer, actually the local multiplayer, which is completely distinct, is also really fun and a lot like the N64 GoldenEye. But the online mode is more of a Call of Duty inspired thing. It's got some James Bond themes to it, but it's not heavily James Bondy. It's more Call of Duty, and that was okay with me because, you know, it was a novelty to have that on the Wii. I mean, there were other Call of Duty games, but it was never like the best version of those. And with GoldenEye, it's like there wasn't until a couple years later, there wasn't any other version of that game. And so it didn't feel watered down. It didn't feel compromised. It didn't feel like you were playing with, you know, the sliver of the online community for that game. That was all there was, playing GoldenEye. You were out there, and it really did feel like kind of an elite experience. It was extremely well done. And I thought a fantastic part of the game. And we played we had some staff nights where we got together and played. We did some community events, and I participated in some of those and had a ton of fun. So that would probably be one of mine. Anybody else want to jump in with it?
Really, really for me, it was, we speak chat with the four.
Oh, Jesus.
With the four awful heads.
So let's
I mean, come on.
We've told this story before, but let's set the stage. Johnny, John, and I had attempted to play The Conduit online. And I say attempted because it had just it had decided that every time we'd start a match, we were cheating and would just tell us all we lost.
I remember it would start me with my camera pointing at the sky, and I wouldn't be able to do anything.
It was 8.5 and it up, basically.
Yeah,
that game was a complete mess.
Yeah, and then somebody would come along and kill me, and
we spent an hour trying to get a game going, and I think we played two matches, and because it was just the three of us in this huge space, it was just going, "Where is everybody?" a lot, and
yeah,
just like
bad.
Occasionally you'd hear shooting and you'd run in that direction. But
to be fair, they did clean up the online mode quite a bit in the sequel. Unfortunately, they introduced a game-breaking bug in the first level of the single-player campaign.
Yes.
So they seemed to have trouble getting both of those locked down.
So But what we had was we all had WeSpeaks, so we all had access to the WeSpeak channel. And we, after going through the joys of The Conduit, decided, let's go fuck off into the WeSpeak channel and see what's over there.
Boy.
Yeah, because we knew that we would never use it again.
Right. And what we found instead was an Alice in Wonderland dystopia of giant me giant me heads that would explode to the front of the screen when someone was talking and then recede back when they were quiet.
Bizarre Brady Bunch opening sequence.
And they're the animated when you talk. It looks kind of like the Canadians in South Park. It's just weird flappy mouths and lots of strange sound effects you can do.
Everybody would look at the person who's talking while their head just went ballistic on the screen.
Now, couldn't you also distort your voice?
Yes.
Why?
It's such a fever dream. It's amazing.
We couldn't believe what we were going through.
We talked for years about trying to figure out a way to like video capture it and do like a YouTube podcast version of this show through the WeSpeak channel, because it would be so funny, but the logistics of it just didn't make sense at the time. People put their game streams up on YouTube all the time, but back in 2009, 2010, it was a different story, and we just didn't have the technology to make it happen.
It was easily one of the most bizarre things that I've ever done on a Nintendo system. It's
completely hilarious. I mean, very entertaining.
Yeah.
Very.
It was a once in a lifetime thing, for sure.
It was so busted.
Yeah.
So
complete mess.
I want to talk about, personally, I want to talk about Smash Brothers. Because it was a goddamn disaster. John, there's the story that John and I trying to get our Wiis to recognize we're friends for weeks. And there's an episode somewhere, somebody can find it, good job, where we chronicle our various experiments to make our Wiis recognize, hey, we're friends.
Yeah, had both added each other's friend codes, and we were just sitting there waiting for the magic to happen.
Yeah,
we
would add other people, and it'd pick them up.
Immediately.
But it's like, fuck off these two. But the few games I got of that to work, like legitimately, properly work.
Yep.
And it's few. I mean, there were only a few of them. Yeah. Were really ridiculous. Now,
great, and they were super fun.
Part of the problem, of course, is that you would have to discuss the stupidity of whatever just happened with the person you're playing it with through a secondary mechanism. So the games I played, like I had somebody on Skype while we were – the old busted – oh, we can't – older busteder Skype. And we're trying to play, six or seven rounds, maybe two work. But it was just, it was just something kind of fun about, like, you do something, and there was kind of lag, but it didn't really matter because Smash Brothers is so ridiculous anyway. You didn't really notice. So it worked out really nicely.
And I noticed something. I tried to play with Greg a few times. I played with him enough to see that he is amazing with Yoshi, which is one of his favorite Nintendo characters in general, and he really is very good at the game. But the lag was unbelievable. I mean, it was as bad as we've ever seen with Skype. And I don't even think we were trying to use Skype at the same time because, clearly the connection was bad enough already. We didn't want to push it any further. But that was one of the saddest things I think that has ever happened in video gaming, in my opinion, for such an amazing franchise to be hit in the gut like that with a huge, ambitious new online feature that just pretty much doesn't work 90% of the time is devastating. Absolutely devastating. And I think it's probably for this year with the new Smash Brothers coming out on Wii U and 3DS, I think it's the single biggest unanswered question. And we're not going to know until the game is out, basically. But if that game, if the online mode actually works, that might become one of my favorite games of all time and one of my most played games of all time. Yeah. But it's such a huge question mark because they've shown so little competence for it.
Yeah,
Brawl and now.
It's pretty sad that we're sitting here a decade down the line still saying, we don't know if Nintendo's online is going to work really well.
Yeah.
It's sad.
I mean, to be fair, people are saying the same thing about Titanfall, after Battlefield 4 and SimCity. I mean, shit is broken.
Yeah,
like, it's hard to make online games. It's hard to make them work smoothly.
But if you pull it off, it's
everything. But Nintendo, I feel like, is kind of in the same boat as EA. Like, I have no faith in them whatsoever that they're going to make it work correctly.
Exactly.
But if they do, it will be life-shattering. I mean, it will be crazy.
Yeah.
Yeah, Smash Brothers was a fucking tragedy.
But I don't think we had a good one until Mario Kart Wii, I guess.
Yeah, I agree. Mario Kart Wii was a game where it didn't really matter if the, you know, the connection was not all that hot. They could cheat their way
and make you think you're still playing.
No, but you know, like they could make the drivers appear in front of you or behind you or whatever, and it didn't really, you didn't notice it as much as when you're playing, you know, a very precise brawler. And I had a great time. I don't play online games a lot. It's not really something that I kind of prefer, you know, playing games on my own terms. unless it's very structured and someone tells me, okay, we're going to have like this big group of people playing every Wednesdays and are you in, you know? Okay, sure. Like mm-hmm. I'll play some Left 4 Dead.
But I mean, to be honest, part of that too is the fact that you've been primarily a Nintendo gamer.
No, but right? I used to play Left 4 Dead 2 with a group of people on PC.
Yeah, on PC, and, yeah.
Yeah, and eventually on the Negative World, there was a Mr. Mustache who decided to set up a tournament, 12 people, pretty much always like the same people all the time, for about 3 months. We played two sets of races every week, and we would, at first, like everyone would note down their the points that they would get, and eventually I just like, oh, fuck this, and just took pictures of the screen when the points, the rankings would pop up. But yeah, like we would tally points every week, and it would be this big thing, this big event, and that was probably the most fun that I've ever had racing people online, and probably some of the most fun I've had playing Mario Kart just in general. Because I never really had like this group of people. I didn't have a Nintendo 64 in college. It was really, really great. But then it ended, and I sold Mario Kart.
And it ended. Jeez. One other I was thinking about just now. One other thing that I remember, and this will come up in two part. I remember distinctly them spending an inordinate amount of time describing Wii Connect 24, which is essentially the Wi-Fi connection where
it was basically
idle.
The NFC feature of the Wii.
It's been used about as much as NFC as well. Hey-o. You know,
it's Spot Pass. I mean, it's exactly the same idea. It kind of automatically delivers content to your system.
It worked, let's sketchily, but I remember they made a huge deal about it, thinking, oh, that's going to be really cool. And then I remember ultimately forgetting it even existed until just recently when my Wii started blinking at me to tell me that it's not going to do that anymore.
Hey, you should buy a Wii U.
Thanks, Nintendo. The other thing that I remember specifically about Mario Kart, which is what I was getting to here, is the really stupid Mario Kart app you had to download to find out what your friends were doing.
Yeah, that was just goofy.
It's even an app. Channel.
Yeah, the Mario Kart channel.
You installed it from the disc.
That was, that's right. You didn't even download it.
It's super bizarre.
About that.
It's really strange.
The Mario Kart channel really was just, you didn't have, it was completely optional. I think it was
Mm-hmm.
If you want to very quickly find out, are any of my friends playing, you can do that without having to load up the whole game and go through a ton of menus. And then if they are, you could load the game. Of course, the disc had to be in because there's no hard drive on the Wii. So, you know, there wasn't enough storage to install the full game. But you had to have the disc in. But you could at least from the channel see, oh, yeah, Billy's on right now. I want to try to join his race. And you could do that. And then it would load up the disc directly from that channel. And, of course, if no one was playing or you weren't interested, you could just back out of it and go play something on Virtual Console. I mean, it's a neat idea in theory. It's so specific, and because it required the disc especially, I think it just wasn't that useful.
Right. And maybe if it had been like a universal app for every Nintendo game,
but
that would have been cool. But it also would have required friend codes to be like unique to the system and not unique to every freaking game.
Yeah. It's like most things, it was clumsily implemented.
Well, I can understand it for DS because, you know, the whole Wi-Fi connection thing was really kind of added after the fact. I mean, obviously they knew they wanted to do it because they put a Wi-Fi antenna in the system when they built it, but that service wasn't ready until long after the DS system was finalized and launched.
Yeah.
So I can understand why they might need to do it on a per game basis at that point because it wasn't part of the firmware that they shipped with. But with Wii, there's just no excuse. With that system coming out in 2007, the fact that they hadn't done a better job on the friend code thing, I mean, that you had a separate friend code for your system.
Right.
Mm-hmm.
Versus that you all the games. The Wii Messenger, by the way.
It's just unbelievable. Wii Messenger was a thing. So stupid. So, and then, you know, there weren't even any online games for Wii until well into 2007.
Mm-hmm. And so, the thing is, it was really, unless you were buying the game at launch afterwards, it was really hard to find other people to play with, but also just to exchange friend codes with, because they mm-hmm. would have a full friends list and just, you know, like you're out of luck. You can't add anyone.
Yep.
And they've probably gotten bored of even playing the game at that point.
Mm-hmm. Man, a full friends list, that's hours worth of work. Just you know, look them up and put in codes and check message boards back and forth and remind your friends, hey, I added you, but you still haven't added me. You know, please, do you like me? Check yes or no. I mean, the whole thing is so awful.
It's just and yeah, they've come a long way,
but we're talking about the past, not the present. The present is far superior, but still has issues. But Mario Kart Wii, I mean, we've mentioned that really was kind of the first great, really well-done game. Of course, you still had to deal with friend codes, but even if you didn't want to play with your friends, even you just want to play random people, that worked extremely well, too.
Yeah.
And I thought the experience was generally very smooth, even with 12 people on the track, which just seems like a lot, you know, considering Nintendo's history with getting this stuff to work. It can't even get two players to play Smash Brothers well together, much less four or 12 in Mario Kart. It worked surprisingly well and was really fun.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, I mean, I've said many times before, I've played the hell out of Mario Kart Wii. Love that game. My wife played the hell out of it. I mean, we just...
Yeah,
love
you
it.
Could hop on two players online.
Yeah, it was perfect. Great. It was perfect
that's
for that.
That's a great feature. Yeah.
Great game. So, and I mean, really, and that's kind of what amazes me. I mean, in terms of them pulling the plug, what amazes me is that they did not. I mean, I looked just out of curiosity how many people bought Mario Kart Wii, and that sold to about a full third of people that bought the console.
Oh, yeah. It was on the top 10 list forever.
Yeah. I mean, it sold like something like 34 million copies, and. Which they still just pulled the plug on it. I mean, that just amazes me. Like, there's still so many Wiis out there, so many copies of this game out there, and people are still playing it. It's not like you go on there and it's dead. It's like, you can get into a game like Lickety-Split, no problem whatsoever, totally full lobby, and they're just killing it.
The thing is, Wii is not set up for this, but if Nintendo could sell an expansion pack for that online, kind of like New Super Luigi U... I mean, they couldn't really do it on disc either because nobody carries Wii games at this point. But it would be a big hit. Like, if they had a tangible excuse for people to go pull out that game and go back online with it, I bet a lot of people would because a lot of people had really good memories of that. And by the way, like John said, almost everybody already has that game. If you have a Wii and you do, then you probably have Mario Kart Wii and you've probably played it online before. So, you know, I wish there was a way for them to refresh it a little bit, but the Wii just isn't set up. Now Mario Kart 8 on Wii U may very well have those kind of hooks built into it because it's really a no-brainer.
Yeah. Now, the reason they're pulling the plug on the online, does it have to do with the fact that it was using, like it was a GameSpy service and isn't GameSpy kind of pulling out of the whole
has a lot
thing,
to do with it,
They're just in the spying business now.
Yeah, exactly.
Now. Yeah, I think that they, I mean, the first thing I thought was, they probably had a 10-year contract with GameSpy, and it's not worth their money to bring the stuff in-house. And they're obviously it's not worth their money to keep going with GameSpy at this point, because the Wii is dead in the water. So it's just the timing of it and a money thing.
Yep.
So.
And it's a shame. I mean, it doesn't really affect me. You know, I haven't played a game on this service in quite a while, but I do think it's kind of sad because I'm sure there are people who still play it quite a bit, you know?
Yeah.
And it's sad that in the archival sense of, I wish I could go back and, you know, if I feel like getting up a GoldenEye or even trying Smash Brothers again in a couple years, just, hey, I wonder if it even works anymore. You won't be able to do that. I mean, you can today, but you won't in a couple of months.
Yeah.
And that's a shame, but it's not the end of the world either. I mean, I think, you know, if there were a lot of games that were so heavily dependent on it, if there were MMOs and like multiplayer only online shooters and stuff like that, but there really aren't.
Yeah.
So.
Now, somebody said on Twitter, the Wii Mini, does that come with Mario Kart? That comes with Mario Kart,
but
doesn't it?
It doesn't
have
internet.
And it does not have internet. Wow, it doesn't have Ethernet or Wi-Fi.
Oh, Nintendo.
Yeah.
Well, see, Nintendo. The thing about that that makes the least amount of sense is you can't access the well, not the eShop. Oh God, the Wii Shop channel.
Right. That's right. So that's, think of the lost revenue there. And the Wii Mini also doesn't support GameCube controllers, so a lot of the it's a very weird device.
It's like the opposite.
We should clarify though
it's
that
for us.
We should clarify that the Wii Shop channel and the DSi wear
still work,
channel
yes.
will still work after this. So they're only shutting down the. That's why we know you can tell it's related to GameSpy because it's not about Nintendo servers and keeping those up. It's about that other stuff. So it is definitely related to GameSpy, and you know, so it's too bad, but I don't know. I'm not going to mourn it so much as I did feel like it was a good excuse to think back on all the ups and downs we had with it over the years, but I'm not super upset about it, you know, and I can kind of understand it.
Yeah, it's a very, you know, it's kind of amazing that it's very hobbled together solution they had for providing online play. It's kind of amazing that it continued for 10 years. Because, I mean, you have things like the Mario Kart channel, which really are just sort of like, okay, we need lobbies, but we don't really support lobbies, so let's throw something together real quick to make lobbies work. It's kind of like they continually had to find solutions for things, and ultimately they did for 10 solid years, which is kind of impressive. I mean, it's a situation they made of their own mistakes, but it's impressive they managed to keep it going.
Yeah, I mean, I just wish they would have had a little bit more care in terms of, you know, thinking it out, obviously, but also just, you know, the shutdown just seems so sudden and really, I mean, bring a couple of those games in-house. I mean, just a couple of them.
Yeah, just Picross DS. It's got an online versus mode.
I want my latent download puzzles forever that are already on the cartridge.
There's just nothing else like it. Picross DS online is actually really, really fun. Go play that while you still can, people.
Tetris.
If I had a little more faith in the Virtual Console service, I would say maybe they will, you know, release these games eventually on their new systems and rewrite the back end code for the online stuff and make it work on Wii U or 3DS. The history of Nintendo's work in that arena gives me very little hope for that, but it would be nice.
It's just sad to me because
on the other hand, I mean, they're obviously releasing new games in these series that you can migrate over to, but you know, people have their reasons for wanting to stick with the old thing.
Yeah, it just makes me sad because there are many lesser games out there that still have online service for them from Microsoft, Sony, whoever.
Yeah.
And Nintendo's killing some of these games that are awesome. So,
yeah, I mean, the online part of them is not always the awesome part of the games, but, you know, it does kind of throw a stinky eye over some of these games that are otherwise so great.
Yeah. Yeah, and I mean, some of these games where, you know, the reason why I still care about them is the online stuff, and there's so few of them on Wii that it just pretty much burns me that I'm like, okay, you had one job, Nintendo. Just keep the fucking Mario Kart Wii servers running. That's it. Yeah. That's all I care about.
Well, I mean, we can say that this won't happen at least the same way for the same reasons with Nintendo Network, the current online service, because that is done in-house with Nintendo. I think they maybe bought a company to help them do it, but they do run it internally. So when they shut down, you know, the servers for Wii U and 3DS games, it will be their choice. It will be because of cost. And I would imagine Nintendo is the kind of company that is reticent to do something like this. I bet they're squirming about this whole thing and all the bad PR because, you know, a company like EA may just kind of slough it off and say, well, fuck them.
They hate us anyway. Fuck off.
I feel like this is the kind of thing Nintendo does not like to release games with bugs, and they do not like to retroactively add bugs to their games. And, you know, having a menu item that you go to and it tries to connect and it just won't work, I think that should drive them crazy. And, I'm sure they're not happy about it.
We call it the online mode in Smash Brothers.
Yeah. So, Billy, why don't we get into Monster Hunter? Because I know our fans would hate us if we, you know, forgot to do that.
So, John, did you play Monster Hunter Online on the Wii?
Yeah, I played a little bit. Yeah, not a whole hell of a lot, but I played a bit of it.
Now, did you Did you use the beauty that was the WeSpeak with this?
Oh, yeah, man. Oh, God. So, WeSpeak. All right. WeSpeak with Monster Hunter. Okay, first off, I couldn't understand what anybody else was saying.
Well, no, John. Everybody lived underwater. That's the
Thank
problem.
Thank God.
Well, yeah. And also the fact, too, I had – because my TV was, I don't know, maybe 10 feet away from me. The WeSpeak, the microphone was not good. So, you had to have it near you. And you practically had to – I don't know if at one point I maybe dangled it around my ears so that I could almost use it like a mouthpiece. But I wound up doing like incredibly crazy stuff like that just to try to get – just to be able to put my mouth close enough to WeSpeak so that other people could even get what I was – even register that I was saying something.
Well,
not necessarily understand me.
It was a 1940s speakerphone. Let's be honest. Like,
yes.
That thing – WeSpeak is giving it way too much credit.
WeYell is actually the more accurate name.
Now, but the thing that was really hilarious, so when you're playing Monster Hunter, you know, the world is divided up into, you know, zones. And mm-hmm. every time you went from zone to zone, it would have a loading section, which is still in try today, on the Wii U, but, when it was loading, the WeSpeak didn't work. So you could be in mid-conversation with somebody, and you don't, you know, when you go into a different zone, your buddy or the people that you're playing with might not be going into a different zone at the same time. So you had to, like, give somebody, hey, I'm going to zone. Or, hey, just hold that thought. And then
BRB.
Yep. And it was
it so
was
awful.
Such a headache. And I remember I was playing it with Garnett because we were talking about it on Weekend Confirmed. And like I went out and I actually bought a WeSpeak so I could test it just because I'm like, well, maybe this, you know, maybe the technology is working. And oh God, like.
But see, the thing is, though, right? And you have to put it into context too, right? Because, you know, at this time, I mean, you're on PSN, you're on Xbox Live, and you're playing, you know, online games. You have full party chat. You're sitting there talking to other players.
Oh yeah, this is like 2009, isn't it?
Yeah.
I mean,
voice chat
is not a new thing.
No, and I mean, good voice chat. I mean, it was
honestly
mind blowing.
And I got to tell you guys, actually, there were DS games that had really good voice chat. I thought in Metroid Prime Hunters it worked extremely well.
Yep.
And you could do it in Animal Crossing, I think. I never played that one,
but there were
a number of games.
It was a little bit washy, but it worked okay.
You could do it in Pokemon, I think. I mean, these were, you know, it helps because the microphone is part of the system, which you're holding probably fairly close to your face. So it's naturally it works, but to think that the same idea that just sort of attaching it into the system or something would – the only way – like John said, I mean, the only way I ever got WeSpeak to work at all was to bring the microphone way up to me. And luckily, it did have a very long cord.
They were intimately aware of that thing's problems.
Well, yeah, you were supposed to – like, that was supposed to go on top of your TV. Like,
it's just still under the sensor bar. Yeah.
That was the whole concept behind it. And so, like, I remember the more and more I got into Monster Hunter. But then the problem is, too, since it's not a part of the system, like, you're already splitting the user base to who anybody was crazy enough to buy a WeSpeak to begin with.
Oh, yeah.
That So other people would have keyboards. But then, like, then you would need a keyboard to type to those people as well.
Oh, that's so stupid.
And so, like,
but see, it also created because it was a mic that picked up anything around the TV. Somebody else would walk into the room and ask you something, and everybody in the game would think that they were talking to them.
Yeah,
So other than the voice chat, though, did you guys find that the online was effective in Try? I mean, that's a game that really lives and dies on its multiplayer. So it seems like it would be pretty important to your enjoyment of it
for the most part. But I mean, once I really got rolling in the game and I was really playing a lot and playing with friends, what we would end up doing is we would use Xbox Live's headset to talk. So we'd have voice chat, but then there'd always be somebody else in the party that wasn't on Xbox Live. So I would also need a keyboard.
Oh my God.
You know, so I could communicate with them. And then you know, by the time I'd wake up the next morning, it would look like the Borg threw up in my living room because there was a keyboard and a microphone, you know, and like an Xbox.
Classic controller, pro.
Yeah. Oh, God. Yeah. I forgot about
it's
that.
It's a shame
too,
we didn't support the ASCII keyboard control. You'd be good to go.
I know. Everything I have that thing.
I haven't held one in so long. I tried it at E3 one time, and I was in love with the silliness of it. And I immediately wanted one.
It's the only
but
thing I need in my collection to make me happy.
Yeah, it's like the Virtual Boy. It's like the 64DD to me. It's like something that I have absolutely no use for whatsoever, but I so want one.
I love Virtual Boy games. Anyway, let's move on to a different topic.
All right. It doesn't involve me owning the keyboard controller. Come on, man.
That thing was awesome, by the way. I had used it for Phantasy Star Online because that was like the only thing that was
it's the only thing it supported.
But it was awesome. It melded a controller and a keyboard.
Literally.
Together.
That's literally what it was.
Yeah.
It was awesome.
And it's surprisingly small and shockingly comfortable.
It's bizarre.
It was super sweet.
It's amazing. Yeah, we should put up a photo of that, you know, on the podcast art, because it's if you've never seen that thing, you're not going to believe that it's real. I promise you that it is.
Looks like a Photoshop.
It really does.
I will speak briefly in defense of Wii Speak, very briefly. Playing Animal Crossing Wide World, whatever it was called. Let's go to the city, whatever it was in your region. Playing that online, I had somewhat better Wii Speak experiences with that game than other games. Now, it came with that bundled in the box. No. I think you can have multiple people in town. It'll still work.
Wild World was DS.
Not Wild World. I said the wrong name. The City Folk.
Okay.
Yeah.
It was the same game.
Because it had a city in it, damn it. It wasn't the same game. You can say that about all the Animal Crossing games.
It was kind of a port plus though
that worked okay. I don't know why that game worked better than other games, but of all the games that use it, that's the only one where I could reasonably intuit what the person was saying,
because I don't think there was much latency needed. You know, there's not a lot
that's
going
just
on
crazy. Yeah, it was like that's the only game where you could get an approximation of what the other person was telling
you.
The problem with
City Folk was just occasionally just wouldn't let you connect. So it was a different issue.
Mm.
But we're okay. It's okay.
It's just crazy seeing the difference between playing Try and then just a few years later playing it on Wii U, and like the online is fantastic.
Yeah.
Mm-hmm. And the microphone's built into the controller.
It works ridiculously well. You're like, this is amazing. Like, it just.
Why were headsets so unacceptable?
Why are they still unacceptable, really? I mean, it's still built into the controller.
Well, I mean, I think that's at least, that's the minimum that they should offer. And I think it works pretty well. But yeah, I mean, you should also be able to, actually, you can use a headset on Wii U. Yeah, you can totally do it. I've plugged in my iPhone headset with the microphone built in.
That's what
it
I
totally
use.
Works. Yeah, I forgot about that.
Because you'll get a lot
it's,
of
that's the problem with me
have,
on
like,
Wii U. It's been so long since I actually played a Wii U game online that I can't even remember what it's like. Hopefully that will change in the year 2014.
Radio Free Nintendo.
There you go. There's hardly anything that even supports
that.
That's not our fault.
I played Tekken a little bit.
I would like to be playing some online games on Wii U, but you know, certainly ain't happening in Nintendo's games
until
2 years after the system comes out, because they're medieval. Anyway,
that's what guys, it comes back to. That's the word to describe
medieval
Wi-Fi
internet
connection.
Yep.
Yeah.
Medieval.
Well, guys, I'm sure that this is not something that any of us used on any kind of regular basis, probably. But obviously, we all dabbled in Nintendo Wi-Fi connection and had some really good times with it, some very bad times with it. But in closing, I kind of wanted to go around the table, around the, you know, the metaphorical table, and kind of ask you guys for your kind of summary of your thoughts on it. I mean, just in a couple of sentences, maybe. How do you look back on it now that the service is closing out and we have to say goodbye to it?
I think I had already started abandoning the DS Online just because it was what's the name of that protocol that no one uses anymore?
Oh, the WEP.
Yeah, WEP.
Yeah, it was the only one that was. It was the only one that you could use, right? With the original DS
games.
That's
right.
They updated that with the DSi. No, with the...
On the DSi, but only for the shop. To play multiplayer stuff, you still have to use WEP.
Yeah.
Right.
Correct. Yeah, that's how they maintain the backwards compatibility.
Like, I had to change the encryption all the time on my router, and that entailed having, like, bringing the laptop to the router and connecting it.
Good grief.
It was just too much work, and I think I actually did that for a while with Dragon Quest IX just to get the items from the shop.
Which were already on the cartridge, by the way.
I know, I know. But I wanted those items. It was the only way to do it.
Oh, my God.
And then I tired of that, I went and bought the dongle, actually. I somehow found it. Someone was still selling it. And then I realized, oh, shit, I have Windows 7.
Yeah.
So I never could use it. And, anyway,
you got
so
the fan hacked firmware update for it that supports Windows 7.
Oh yeah.
Oh, I never found that.
There probably is. Useful. I mean, people hack their routers all the time. I bet you there's a. Mm. I bet there's a pirate Windows 7 version of that of the software for that thing. I bet you.
No, I think there was. Yeah.
Just to conclude quickly. There were some fun stuff like Picross DS. Definitely try that if you have that and you've never tried the online. And
you mean Picross 3D, the only Picross game?
No, Picross DS. Like I know 3D is pretty cool, but it doesn't have multiplayer. Picross DS has multiplayer and it's pretty good.
If you're trying to tell me that anything is better than Picross 3D, then I don't want to.
Hey, Picross DS didn't electrocute me at PAX East. Picross 3D definitively did electrocute me at PAX East.
I forgot.
It didn't
that
do the
story.
Job well enough.
One of these games tried to kill me. The other game didn't.
And Advance Wars Days of Ruin remains the only online Advance Wars, right?
So yes.
That's right, and it's the one that no one has and no one's played. It's very sad.
Yeah. And it's got really asymmetrical maps and unfair maps.
Yep.
So,
it's perfect for online play.
Yep.
We broke this game, then put it online. Fuck you.
Smash Brothers could probably say the same thing. All right, James, what about you? What's your kind of – how do you look back upon it?
I look back on Nintendo Wi-Fi connection as kind of this weird mystical dream that happened. That it just – it seems like they put themselves in a really bad corner really early. Mm. And then spent the next 10 years trying to find their way out of the jungle to kind of make this whole – crazy setup work.
Mm-hmm. Like if you look at the beginning and the end of it, it really is, it's like watching a toddler try to walk for the first time. I mean, they went into it understanding so little of how to do it properly. And by the end, they still don't really have the motor skills down to pull it off smoothly and I'm talking about Wi-Fi connection, not Nintendo Network, but
there you go.
You know, they really have put in the best effort they possibly could, and they've really improved as much as they can, but they still can't really pull it off every time. You know, it still feels like they're struggling a lot with it.
It was an ocean of bizarre things that just don't make sense. And anytime you cracked open a Wi-Fi connection game, you may have a good experience, and that may be great. You may have a completely bonkers experience that makes no sense.
Mm-hmm.
And it was never weird the same way either. There was all kinds of strange things that would happen that you just didn't go, all right, sure. And part of that, I mean, it's easy to make fun of because it's awful and it shouldn't be that way. But in a way, it was kind of disturbingly charming. Like you just sort of
that's
go
like Stockholm syndrome though, man.
A little bit, but it was amusing more than anything. You're like, whoa.
I mean, how is that funny? I know what you mean. It's janky in the way of like playing Quake 2 online. You know, back in 96 or 97 is. You know, it's like, wow, this totally works, and it's kind of fun, but it makes very little sense, and it bugs out all the time, and everybody's got wildly different connection rates
because,
you know, they're not equipped for really doing this, and the game isn't really balanced properly for all this stuff that's going on. People are finding exploits and cheats, and it's very much like Wild West, mid to late 90s online gaming, you know, except a decade removed.
As somebody who's old, I will correct you in saying that Quake 2 was fucking amazing back in the day, and it worked really well. And it actually wasn't that janky. Like, when people were hacking, like, Doom and stuff, to get it to, you know, for networking and things like that, then yeah, it was, that was a little janky. But like late 90s online gaming on PC wasn't that hard.
I would say, I would put it to mid 90s. Like,
and that's when like GameSpy, yeah, like that shit was awesome back in the day.
That was their heyday. Yeah, I mean,
and that's how,
back in 2004 when we found out that GameSpy was handling this stuff, it was already kind of old tech. Like it already wasn't really the best way to do it at the time. And it was real weird.
Well, they were handling, I think GameSpy's technology was doing a lot of the console stuff for like PS2 and some,
yeah,
of like,
a lot
of the,
yeah,
that,
four
that
online
Luminary
games.
Example.
Yeah.
PS2, yeah, really. Online. Oh boy.
The router plugs into the optional hard drive. What?
Yeah, no, yeah, but I mean, I do want to point out, by the time we went online finally, in 2006, 2007, Xbox Live was very well established at that point.
Oh,
like,
yeah.
there is a very clear example of how to do this properly, and Nintendo was like, huh? I mean, just completely oblivious.
Well, they were not aware of anything that happened on the
ignorant.
Xbox side.
They're like, we're going to do it our way, and fuck you.
Yeah, I think the thing is, I think when people look back on it, I think that the whole Wi-Fi connection kind of experiment, more than anything, accounts for how Nintendo is perceived in general nowadays. Because pretty much people got to watch this slow-mo train wreck of Nintendo trying to get online over a 10-year period. Meanwhile, Sony was outpacing them, Microsoft was outpacing them, and just making them look foolish when they can't even get the simplest of games online to work. And, I mean, and the thing is, while...
Didn't it also prove, though, that doesn't matter that much for mainstream success? You know, with DS and Wii both being such runaway successes, I think it showed that, yeah, if you don't get the online right, you're going to piss off your hardcore fans and the people who want this very specific feature set and kind of experience. But, hey, yeah, there's plenty of people who don't give a shit, and they're going to buy it either way. And I mean, that may be different today, but back in the mid-2000s, I think certainly, demonstrably, people didn't care that the online was broken.
Yeah,
you know?
I think people didn't care then. But I think the thing is, I think Nintendo paid the price in the long run, because I think that they lost out. Because they farmed it off to GameSpy, they lost the opportunity to actually get that expertise in-house, which they are still don't have it.
That's an excellent point. And, like I said, they're learning very quickly now.
Yeah, I mean, they're still 10 years behind in terms of online stuff. I mean, even right now, they're still kind of at this experimental phase, whereas you have Microsoft and Sony. They're sitting there saying, well, we do all of this stuff really, really well. Now they're just sitting there. They're just tweaking the knobs and trying to make the experience better. Meanwhile, Nintendo is over here still trying to, like, put the wheels on the car.
Yeah,
so,
I mean, can you imagine Nintendo announcing Twitch TV streaming integration with Wii U?
Yeah.
Give me a break.
Yes. So, yeah, I mean, I think probably if you could ask them, like, they probably would have brought it in-house, I think, if they could do it over again. But
I think absolutely they would. Not even with the whole shutdown thing. I think just for the opportunity to learn how to do this.
Yeah. At the time, they were just like, look, we're going to outsource this. We're going to take the cheapest, easiest way out just to appease you people who won't shut up about it.
Yeah. And I don't think they were really convinced about the business model either. I think Microsoft and Sony, honestly, because Nintendo does do this historically, they will kind of let, you know, competitors fumble about, waste a bunch of money, and then Nintendo will come in and kind of do what they did better.
And
like, you see this with games a lot.
In a different way and waste a bunch of money.
Yeah. And, you know, so, you know, I think that they were kind of content at the time to do that. But the problem was, I don't think that they were looking far enough out, whereas Microsoft and Sony kind of were, you know, they kind of saw where things were going, whereas Nintendo was like, well, you know, we've had success doing what we always do. And we've always, you know, no one's really going to tell us that we can't have that success going forward. So I don't know, they kind of dropped the ball on that. But
all right, John, that was a lot more than a few sentences, but I take responsibility for it as well. just very quickly, my own summary before we wrap it up with Billy is, you know, I think as I look back in whole, if I'm not thinking about very specific experiences, but I kind of think back about my overall impression of Nintendo Wi-Fi connection, it's pretty positive. And I think it's because a lot of these connection problems and, you know, kind of half thought out features like we speak, they were very frustrating at the time, but they are obviously pretty humorous in retrospect. Maybe that's just how I'm dealing with it, but they don't bother me that much in looking back. And more what I think colors my overall memory of it is that I got to play Nintendo games online for the first time in my life. Like kind of really a very long held dream. And a lot of times when it worked, it was really fun. And it was, if nothing else, always enticing. I always wanted more. I wanted it to work better so that I could play these games and get more enjoyment out of them. I wanted more games to support online because I felt the potential was there and some games really kind of scratched at it. And so for me, it really was certainly unfulfilled potential, but not a worthless experiment. You know, for me, I did get enjoyment out of it. There are at least a few games that I felt it greatly enhanced. And you know, even the games where it really didn't work well at all, I still got a fair bit of enjoyment out of games like Brawl, even playing it by myself and playing it locally. Not nearly as much as I wanted to, but that's a testament to the fact that I really like that game. I would have liked more ways to play it. I would have liked even more longevity for it. So, and ultimately, I do think they learned some very difficult lessons. It took longer than it should have for the reasons that John just explained. But I do think it was a learning process for them, and I think they learned some things, some very important things, and I think they're implementing those now. So I can't be that harsh on it. I mean, I can if we're talking specific stories, but overall, I'm glad they did it. So let's move on to Billy and your kind of overall wrap-up for this thing. How do you – you weren't as embedded in it as we were maybe, but obviously you were involved and exposed to it as well.
Well, I was definitely invested in it for someone who wanted to play those games online, and I think Geese summed it up best when he said it was too much work. Like, it was so much work to just get it to, you know, it's like, it's not even like the broken TV where you got to hit it right to get it to work right. It was like, you just had to do so much, and for people like us who are that invested into it or really understand the tech to get it to work really well. Like one of my best friends who lives in Minneapolis, like to get him to try to get GoldenEye to work on the Wii to play multiplayer, he was like, he just didn't have the patience for it. And I mean, talking about it took 20 minutes for us to like, you know, cause he didn't get the concept of friend codes and all that other shit. And like, you know, like, it just, for people, for the general public, it is too much work. Like,
and it's so un-Nintendo, really. Like, it was Nintendo completely going against their own, you know, mantra and design philosophies. It should just work.
And as somebody, they're like, we're going to make this so difficult to use that the pedophiles won't even bother.
True, but like it's true.
I know many pedophiles, and they were never on.
They were some lazy bastards.
Yes, they found other avenues, but seriously, like, I was excited to play games like Mario Kart or Tetris or things like that online? Yeah, but for somebody who has been playing online games for a really long time, as I said, you know, back in the day, I played a ton of Quake 2 in games like that online on my PC. Like, it just made me, you know, and I expected the GameCube back when, you know, early days of Planet GameCube, like, that system should have been online.
I mean,
more.
Yeah, it's.
And it wasn't. Mm-hmm. Like, the Dreamcast had a frickin' modem.
Built in. Not as an optional attachment. The Dreamcast modem was built into the system.
Yep.
it had online games. It had a bunch of them.
Had a better voice chat implementation than we.
But I would like to point out that it is amazing that Nintendo developed not one but two distinct routers for the GameCube, and then only two games ever came out from Sega that used them effectively.
I think there was a third, but anyway, I mean, it's just, for me, it was like just a head scratcher, you know, like usually a company like Nintendo makes things really intuitive and really easy to do. They have historically been very forward thinking as far as technology. I mean, Christ, look at the WaveBird. That was still one of the best wireless controllers up until like probably the 360 controller. I mean, it was just, they used to do things super right on a lot of things. I mean, yeah, we're still talking about Nintendo here, so they did a lot of things wrong too, but it was just frustrating, you know, and as somebody who really did dream about playing on, you know, Nintendo games online with my friends and make it easy, like, it just, this wasn't it. And, you know, and there's still, I agree exactly with what John said too. Like, I think it's, you know, like, even when people bought the Wii U, like, they're like, does this work? Like, even when I bought Monster Hunter for Wii U, it was like, I was like, holy shit, it works.
Yeah.
Like,
yeah.
I was like, my mind was blown. And this is 2013.
Yeah.
You know, and, like.
Just for comparison, Xbox Live went live in November 2002.
Yeah, it did.
Billy was there when it happened, I think.
Yeah,
he was there when they flipped the big switch.
Well, I had an Xbox, but I when I was doing Planet GameCube, Microsoft flew me out to go to this Xbox Live boot camp thing, and they wanted to get my opinion because I was from the GameCube side.
Oh,
and isn't that cute? Like, they thought Nintendo might be a competitor in the online market, and wanted to get an outsider's perspective on their new service.
Yeah, and back then it was, you know, completely remarkable. And then on 360, they really perfected.
I'm sure everyone at that event was like, "What the hell are you doing here?"
Yeah, it was a random group of people, like people from Team Xbox, Petty Arcade guys were there.
Of course, they were local, so that helps a little bit.
They were local, yeah, and that's where I got to know those guys. But like, yeah, it was just a random, you know. And they're like, "Why are you here? You're the GameCube guy." And I'm like, "Well, you know, they offered to fly me to Seattle. I'd never been to Seattle before." And
all right, guys, so that is going to wrap up our feature and indeed the episode. Before we go, a few things to talk about. I'll try to be very quick. We are discussing the next retroactive feature, and I think it might connect to what we just talked about. We might try to get in on some of the Nintendo Wi-Fi connection action before it all shuts down in a couple of months. So stay tuned for that. If we can narrow down the list of games, I will put it up over the weekend. It might even happen by the time you hear this episode. So look in the show notes, and please follow us on the social media. We'll let you know there. You can like Radio Free Nintendo on Facebook. You can follow Nintendo_NWR on Twitter, and whenever we post something on Facebook, it also goes out to the NWR Twitter account. You can follow me. I'm at Johnny Metz, and John is at Mr. Diamond J. Guillaume is at Guillaume NWR, and James is, I think, at NWR_James.
I am.
And Billy is at Louie the Cat. And we will let you know when the nominees are out, but hopefully this weekend, if not soon after the episode goes up, I'm hoping. And, we'll maybe all get together and you can play some online games with us and we'll talk about them. So, I think that would be really interesting. Also wanted to let you know, we are probably going to get back to listener mail next week. We have a pretty big pile already and some really excellent, emails in there. So thank you for your patience. We will try to catch up on those a little bit next time. The address to send in your question for the group is rfn@nintendoworldreport.com, or check out the show notes on nintendoworldreport.com, and you'll find the link there. And finally, Billy, what can you plug, man? Anything going on in the world of Billy?
Well, not. I'm
sounds like
kind
a bad
of between
movie.
Projects right now, but the one thing that I remembered. It was that tomorrow, or the 7th, is the 15th birthday of the origins of, well, I guess, Planet N2000 would be back then, or, you know, but Planet GameCube and now Nintendo World Report. So the website is now 15 years old, which is kind of crazy.
You're plugging us. Thank you.
Yeah, I'm plugging you guys.
It's almost old enough for us to hire it to write for itself.
And Billy, let's not mess around. You're plugging yourself. I mean, you should take so much credit, all the credit, for Nintendo World Report. You are the founder and have supported us so much over the years. So congratulations to you, man. I mean, a 15-year-old website is a rare breed, and I know I'm very proud of it. I've done my part, and I'm allowing myself to feel pretty good about it at moments like this.
As you
I think
all
it's
should.
Amazing.
And Lindy, for his 10 minutes of, you know, doing the site, you know, like, he did a pretty good job too.
It's like 2 years,
buddy,
wasn't it?
Those were 2 years. 2 years.
It's, Nothing to sneeze at, man.
Two years of you asking me when the site update is going to go out.
Oh, God.
That's kind of like being the president of the United States. I mean, all his hair fell out. And
yeah, it's exactly the same.
It's funny to think that that us talking now would never have happened if the site didn't start 15 years ago. And I've gotten to be friends with so many of you guys and see you guys every year at E3 is always a treat. And, it's crazy, and
we outlived Nintendo Wi-Fi connection, guys. We did it.
Yeah.
Take that Wi-Fi connection.
Now we can retire. God, I've been waiting years.
But yeah, so congrats to you and to everybody at Nintendo World Report. 15 years is a incredible milestone, and while you guys are listening to it, I look back on our early years, and you will laugh your ass off on some of the worst writing ever.
Oh man, we've come a long way.
Yep, it's definitely crazy. So, so congrats to everybody, and happy birthday to the website. So.
Awesome. Thanks, man. Yeah, congrats to the dozens upon dozens, maybe even hundreds of people who have who've contributed to the website as staff members, and the many, many, many thousands of people who have patronized us and used the forums and supported us in all kinds of endeavors, including this crazy podcast. So thank you very much, Billy, for saying that. Thank you so much for coming on. You were a fantastic guest, as usual. And good luck to everything you're doing, man.
Thanks.
So that's it. Thanks for listening, everybody. We will be back next week with more Radio Free Nintendo.
Later.
Bye.
Bye.
Ketchup potato chips.